United States has an insatiable appetite for conflict. And since going into Korea in the 1950s, it's been at war with someone or other in some corner of the globe non-stop right up to the present day. This drive is now led by the weapons manufacturers themselves. It's a highly dangerous precedent. I call it war corporatism. It is the door of a new fascism being pushed open. And don't be fooled, not all fascism looks like Adolf Hitler.
This week in Radical History for the week starting February 2nd.
There is something going on in the ether.
The kids are now moving back into the street.
For every Martin they cut down, there must be 100 Martins to step into his shoes. Hey!
On this day, February 2nd in 1848, a treaty was signed which ceded even more of Mexico to the U.S. Known as the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo, named after the chapel and the town in which it was signed, Mexico ceded nearly 55% of its total land area and the people who lived on that land to the United States for a mere $15 million. The newly annexed area included all of California, Nevada, and Utah, and Colorado, most of Arizona, and much of New Mexico, and even a portion of Wyoming. This Day in History is a production of the Neighborhood Network in Columbus, Ohio. I'm Evan Davis.
Also on February 2nd, 1905, Ayn Rand lives. Right-wing dandy, author of The Fountainhead, and the philosophy exploiting greed and individual acts without consciousness. She'd later be reincarnated as Ann Coulter. Okay, I'm really not sure about that part. Maybe it was Rush Limbaugh or Dick Cheney. Also on February 2nd, 1931, as the Depression worsens, public officials across the Southwest decide it would be cheaper to send legal residents back to Mexico than to carry them on the welfare rolls. During the decade's first 4 years, well over 400,000 Mexican-Americans, many U.S. citizens living here as long as 40 years, are repatriated. Some families, as a result, are split because the father or mother or both would be considered alien. Also on February 2nd, 1951, the first 4 of 7 blacks convicted of raping a Martinsville, Virginia white woman are executed. By some odd anomaly, to this date only one white has ever been executed for raping in Virginia's glorious history. Lastly, on this date in 1972 in Ireland, 3 days after 13 unarmed civilian rights demonstrators were shot to death by British paratroopers in Northern Ireland, outraged Irish citizens burned down the British embassy in Dublin. This week in Radical History for February 3rd, 1892 in Argentina, U.S. Marines land in Buenos Aires to protect American interests. Also on February 3rd, 1909, French philosopher, syndicalist Simone Weil lives. Her passionate need to share with the suffering of others led her to fight with the anarchist in the Spanish Revolution. Writers as diverse as T.S. Eliot and Albert Camus declare her one of our century's foremost thinkers. Quote, "As I worked in the factory, the affliction of others entered into my flesh and my soul. There I received forever the mark of a slave, like the branding of a red-hot iron which the Romans put on the forehead of their most despised slaves. Since then I have always regarded myself as a slave." Simone Weil. Another outstanding woman in 1910, Mary Harris Mother Jones addresses Milwaukee brewery workers. Mother Jones spent 2 months working alongside women bottle washers in one of the breweries. Her report of the working conditions went like this. "Condemned to slave daily in the washroom in wet shoes and wet clothes, surrounded with foul-mouthed brutal foremen, the poor girls worked in the vile smell of sour beer, lifting cases of empties and full bottles weighing from 100 to 115 pounds in their wet shoes and rags, for they could not buy clothes on the pittance doled out to them. Rheumatism was one of the many chronic ailments and is closely followed by consumption." Mother Jones. Also on February 3rd, 1912, 32,000 Bread and Roses strike in Lawrence, Massachusetts. The Bread and Roses strike began last month and lasts for over 9 weeks. Despite collusion by the government and mill owners and their hired goons, strikers would not waver. Even when 18-year-old Syrian worker John Ramey was killed, and another woman and her 2 sisters were arrested and dragged from their beds in the middle of the night, an Italian woman would suggest, "Tomorrow morning, men no go to picket line. All men, boys stay home, sleep. Only woman, girl on picket line tomorrow morning. Soldier and policeman will not beat girl woman. You see, I got big belly. She too got big belly. Policeman not beat us." The next morning, the women were out in full force, only to be beaten so badly that Italian woman who spoke at the meeting and another pregnant striker lose their babies and almost die. Lastly, on this date, in 1964, 464,000 students, that's about 45% of the entire student population, boycott NYC schools to protest segregation. This week in radical history, for February 4th, 1899 in the Philippines, a U.S. sentry shoots Filipino soldier, sparking a revolt against U.S. occupation. The islands become a U.S. colony following the Spanish-American War. The most barbaric forms of torture and interrogation, as well as scorched-earth military tactics and brutal reconcentration of civilians, were used. Filipino historians estimate that more than 300,000 Filipinos, mostly civilians, perished as a result of the American genocidal policies. Also on February 4, 1956, white students riot at the University of Alabama against court-ordered admission of the first black student. Also on that date in 1972, Senator Strom Thurmond asks Attorney General John Mitchell to deport John Lennon as an undesirable alien. Lastly, on February 4, 1985, 20 countries, but not the U.S. under the Ronald Reagan regime, sign a U.N. treaty outlawing torture. And we saw after 9/11 how much torture is in vogue in America. This week in radical history, for February 5, 1631 in the New World, Roger William, pioneer of religious tolerance, arrives in North America. Hated by the Fundies, in 1647, he'll help establish a colony on Rhode Island, and the liberty of consciousness was proclaimed. The area had briefly become a safe haven for people who were persecuted for their beliefs, like the Quakers or the Jews, and for others who want to follow their consciousness of peace and safety. On May 18, 1652, Rhode Island would pass the first law in North America making slavery illegal. Also on February 5, 1923 in Italy, more mass arrests of socialists, anarchists, and communists occur. Also on that date in 1937, in an attempt to issue rulings favorable to his administration, Franklin Delano Roosevelt requests authority to enlarge and, quote, pack, unquote, the Supreme Court. Also on February 5, 1993, Anthony Summers, a biographer of J. Edgar Hoover, says that he was a homosexual and blackmailed by the mafia for it. Lastly on this date in 2003, U.S. Secretary of State Colin Powell presents the U.S. evidence against Iraq to the U.N. Security Council. Most pieces of evidence turn out to be fabricated and a pack of lies. This is not the first time Powell rolled over for his president. As then first lieutenant in Vietnam, Powell was the initial investigating officer on the My Lai massacre and started the cover-up. This week in radical history, for February 6, 1864, gay individual anarchist, novelist, poet John Henry Mackay lives. Quote six lines of his, I give thee to the future thine secure, when each at least unto himself shall waken, comes it in sunshine, in the tempest thrill. I cannot tell, but it the earth shall see, I am an anarchist, wherefore I will, not rule and also ruled I will not be. Also on the state in 1943, the U.S. orders 110,000 Japanese Americans imprisoned in internment camps and to answer loyalty question surveys. Question number 27 asks draft age men, are you willing to serve in the United States forces in a combat duty wherever ordered? Also on this date in 1950, Republicans adapt the 1950 slogan, quote, liberty against socialism, unquote. Now, a whole 59 years later, they're still fighting this ancient fight.
Why would I want him to succeed? Go back. He's my president. If he gets nationalized health care, I mean, it's over, Sean. That's the end of America as we have known it. Why would I want that to succeed? So I shamelessly say no. I want him to fail.
Nice slogan. Two more items for February 6, 1976 in Canada. Native American activist Leonard Peltier is captured on the basis of fictitious affidavits generated by the FBI. Federal prosecutors later admit they didn't have a clue who committed the crime they convicted Peltier for. The FBI is often fondly referred to, because of its criminal conduct in cases like this, as the Federal Bureau of Fabrication. Lastly, talking about weapons of mass destruction dealers, on this date in 1996, the government admits that to this date it has shipped plutonium to 39 countries over the last 59 years, including Israel, South Africa, Iran, and Iraq. So what now? Do we invade ourselves? This week in radical history, for February 7th, 1885, Germany's August Reinsdorf is executed by decapitation in Berlin. An anarchist and close friend of Johann Most, he is implicated in attempts on the life of Kaiser Wilhelm and his merry band of princes. Reinsdorf's last parting words were, I have nothing to repent, only that the attempt failed. If I had 10 heads, I would offer them with joy and lay them on the block for the good cause. Lastly, in a state in 1968, after America and South Vietnamese air and artillery strikes level the city of Ben Tri, South Vietnam, population of 50,000, a U.S. Army major explains that, quote, it became necessary to destroy the town to save it, unquote.
And when we talk about war, we're really talking about peace.
War is peace.
Freedom is slavery. Ignorance is strength.
This Week in Radical History for February 8, 1851, American feminist writer Kate Choplin lives. Also on this date in 1887, President Cleveland signs the Dawes Land Allotment Act, dissolving Indian tribes as legal entities. It distributes territories held in common by American Indian nations to individual families. Each family will get up to 160 acres. The act ultimately results in a loss of tens of millions of acres of treaty land, driving a nail in the coffin of tribal culture. The congressional committee that proposed the law said it had several goals. The commune shall give way to the dignity and rights of American citizens. The heathen idol shall give place to the Christian altars, and the tribal organization shall be broken up, and the individuality of Indian encouraged and developed, and the lands necessary reserved for them open to the pioneer, so that intelligence and thrift may find lodging there. Also on February 8, 1921 in Russia, the anarchist prince Milton Peter Potemkin dies. Lenin offers a state funeral and burial in the Kremlin Wall, which was refused by his family and comrades. Lastly, in 1988, a panel of international historians issue a report finding that Austrian Kurt Waldheim knew of war crimes committed by his World War II units and that he concealed and misrepresented his service during the war. He, of course, would later be rewarded as the Secretary General of the United Nations. Why not? We got a former Nazi pope. Why not this? That's it for this week in Radical History, produced at the Mobile Fortress of Glee Glee Studios. Inspiration for the segment came from the Slingshot Organizer, and a lot of radical info can be found at the People's Calendar at the Daily Bleed website. This week's ending song is dedicated to Kitty Cutthroat, the most rad person I know. So until next week's edition, a reminder that I'm always and forever yours in a struggle, Mike Cannon.
Tough guy, huh?
Now. It'll hurt less in the morning.
Palestinians cannot force major changes in the policies of the Israeli government that continues with the same colonial, apartheid-like policies that have defined Zionism since the 1947-48 creation of Israel and the dismemberment, disenfranchisement, and dispersal of the Palestinians. But 1.5 million Palestinians of 1948 have become 9 million or so today, and they do have the power to do one thing, whether they live in the West Bank, East Jerusalem, and Gaza, as Israeli citizens inside Israel, or throughout the diaspora around the region and the world. They can and must re-legitimize their national leadership into a single movement that listens to all views, represents them legitimately, reaches policy decisions on the basis of serious consultations and consensus that allows Palestinians to speak in a single voice and engages diplomatically around the world with the full support of Palestinians. None of these dynamics exist today, which is why the current leadership of the PLO under Mahmoud Abbas is not taken seriously in the region or internationally, least of all by the majority of Palestinians themselves, who have looked elsewhere for leadership in the years since the Oslo process proved to be a failure and Yasser Arafat started to lose his credibility. The leaderless condition of the Palestinian people today is reflected in how the three most dramatic examples of public political action in recent years have occurred without any meaningful input from the PLO or from the Palestinian Authority, which administers limited services in regions in the West Bank and Gaza where Israel gives its permission to do so. Those three examples are the current campaign around the world to support Ahmed Tamimi, the 16-year-old girl from a West Bank village who was detained in an Israeli jail pending a possible military court trial because she resisted Israeli occupation and slapped an Israeli soldier. The weeks of spontaneous popular protests last summer in Arab East Jerusalem, when tens of thousands of Palestinians there defended their holy sites at the Haram al-Sharif, and the ongoing boycott, divestment, and sanctions BDS movement by civil society to pressure Israel to stop its mistreatment and human rights denials of Palestinians in the three arenas of occupied Palestine, the State of Israel, and the diaspora. Hamas's challenge to the PLO leadership in Gaza is another sign of the PLO's delinquency in protecting, representing, or leading the Palestinians. It is difficult now to create a whole new national leadership given the fragmented nature of the Palestinian community. Yet the cohesion that all Palestinians feel, wherever they live, also makes it feasible to at least start consultations amongst themselves to find a way out of the current nightmare by giving fresh blood and new life and legitimacy to existing PLO organs. There is no reason why we should suffer this ghastly fate of being plagued by a colonial Zionist Israeli state that steadily eats up our land, ignored by a mostly caring world that is otherwise preoccupied by more pressing issues, and abandoned by a Palestinian leadership that has become powerless, dependent on donors, docile, a purveyor of empty cliches, and largely incoherent. Such situations might lull some observers to see the end of the Palestinian issue, while a more likely conclusion would be that this low point will mark the start of a process of rebirth for the 9 million Palestinians who have never stopped struggling and working for their national rights since the 1930s. They are certainly not going to stop now, regardless of the poor quality of their current leaders. That was an analysis of the current crisis in leadership in Palestine, written by Professor Rami Khoury of the American University in Beirut. And now on to our feature presentation this morning, which is another of the conversations that a group of Boston area travelers had on their trip to Palestine, Israel, through the Gerelta Foundation. They sat down with Ray Dolphin of the United Nations Office of the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, OCHA, assigned to Palestine, Israel. The UN plays a limited but critical role in maintaining the daily affairs of the Palestinian people living under occupation. Ray Dolphin discusses that role in this informal conversation.
Okay, so there's OCHA. It's the Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs. Bit of a long-winded title, but it's the humanitarian arm of the UN. So it's not only in what we call the occupied Palestinian territories. It's a global UN organization, and it was set up in the 1990s to coordinate response after conflict or during conflict, natural disasters and wars. So, for example, there probably will be an OCHA mission following the hurricane to the Caribbean once it passed. That's the type of the disaster response. To coordinate it, not to... Actually, Israel is a member of the global response. They've got quite good experience, I think. So that's... But that's after natural disaster. And then there are certain offices where it's meant to be temporary because the whole emergency humanitarian context is supposed to be temporary. But there are places like Afghanistan and Syria, which are quite long-term missions, as you can imagine, particularly Afghanistan. Yemen, we have a mission for Yemen at the moment. And here is a little bit different because we don't have a natural disaster and we don't have war as such. We have wars in Gaza or conflicts. So this is called a complex emergency. And it's here what we say basically all of the issues here are as a result of violations of international law. Particularly international humanitarian law. We have international humanitarian law and international human rights law, but we do the international humanitarian law, which means here, technically, this is a very easy problem to solve, the Israeli-Palestinian, because it's a small area, small numbers involved, relatively well-off area, particularly on the Israeli side. What's more, there is an internationally approved resolution to the conflict, which in theory everybody has signed up to, with the exception perhaps of Hamas, but the Israelis, the Palestinians, and the international media. And that's the two-state solution, which means there's supposed to be a Palestinian state in the West Bank with some type of shared capital in Jerusalem and then some connection with Gaza, which is stuck over on the other side. And that's been the official, it's been the official position for the international community for probably the last 30 or 40 years. And it's been the official mechanism, if you like, since the Oslo Accords in 1994, which we look at in more depth. However, as you probably know and you'll certainly see in the next 10 days, the reality on the ground is rather different, to the extent that although there's no... Last week we had the Secretary General here. He was sitting exactly where you were. We were doing the same briefing. He said publicly there's no plan B to the two-state solution, but in practice on the ground it doesn't look, to put it mildly, very healthy at this stage. To the extent that a lot of people, including, I must say, myself, unofficially, would say that it's gone. And the fact that there's no plan B is a problem. Now, you will hear, and probably people like Mazen Kamsir will, there are Palestinians who talk about a one-state solution, and there's lots of variations on that, federation, confederation, whatever. I don't have a problem with it. In many ways, it's a more fair or perhaps equitable solution than a two-state solution. The only problem I have with it is I don't think it's ever going to happen.
Seems
so. The idea, if we're stuck between a failing which I think was possible, a two-state solution. I don't think it was necessarily a just solution. I don't think there is a just solution to this, but it was at least a reasonable solution. But if it's gone, which I think it is, and the one-state solution doesn't look, then we're stuck with indefinite occupation, which I suspect is going to be the scenario, at least for the foreseeable future. Who knows? Nobody can tell the future, as you know, and things are changing in the region and globally, but for the foreseeable future. That's, of course, not the UN position. The UN position still is no plan B or plan A, which is the two-state solution, but informally, and perhaps this shouldn't be broadcast, no, it's okay, that's true. Informally and off the record, most people are losing hope in it. And certainly most Palestinians are losing hope in it. Because
it's a sense that we had, you know, we saw you at the beginning of our trip in January. Yeah. The sense that I had from that trip was that Palestinians are much more concerned about having decent lives than additional aspirations to a separate state.
Well, they don't,
the younger ones.
Yeah, they don't see it coming. So what people are doing, I think increasingly you'll see Palestinians go down the civil rights or equal rights. Okay, you don't want to give a state. We won't ask for a state. All we want is the same rights as you, which will take it in a different area and will be much more difficult to argue against.
You talked to Eve Spangler, as I recall. She comes every year to Boston College.
Yeah, yes,
and
correct.
That's exactly, you know, she's got a book that she's made that case exactly the same when you just
well,
made.
I think that's the way it's going to go. As the two-state, I mean, we do have a peace process of, not a process, but something of sorts with President Trump, and who famously said, one state, two state, whatever you're having, I'll have it, or whatever. So we don't know what that means. Frankly, it doesn't look like it's going to amount to very much already. So that's, I mean, the US is still the most important outside actor when it comes to here. The European Union is the pair, the expression there, the pair, but not the player. The European Union, well, actually, the US puts in quite a lot of money as well, but the European Union also has a vested interest. Of course, it's on Europe's doorstep, I think, but they basically step aside and let the US drive things. And we have what's called the quartet, supposedly as the holders of the process, and that's the US, the EU, the Russian Federation, and the UN, which is a bit odd because all of the others are in the UN anyway. So, but effectively it's the US. So if this US initiative doesn't lead to anything, I don't know. I mean, there is no plan B, partly because they don't know what plan B is, but also because to admit now that plan A has failed is a huge admission. All the money that went in, all the energy, all the diplomatic activity, and if after 20, and it is almost 25 years now, you admit that it's all been for naught, then there should be some accountability. So anyway, just to say that we're not in a particularly good situation. And I'm talking mainly of the West Bank because, and we shouldn't forget Gaza, and we look at Gaza first, but ultimately Gaza will either sink or swim, almost literally, depending on what happens in the West Bank, because the West Bank is where it's going to, the particular two-state is going to succeed or fail, and Gaza has no future in and of itself. It needs to be connected with some other, whether the plan of the two-state solution is that it should be connected with the West Bank. The other alternative is to connect it with Egypt. Egypt clearly doesn't want that, but where it is now, and maybe that's a good thing, let's quickly start with... this is where we are. We're here in East Jerusalem, which you can see is the narrowest part of the West Bank. And here's the Gaza Strip over there. Now, when we talk about... We refer to the occupied Palestinian territory, singular, and the reason is that the West Bank and Gaza are supposed to be one territorial unit. Now, there's an obvious problem when you look at the map in that Israel is in between the sovereign state of Israel splits the two. In 1947, when we had the partition plan and there was supposed to be an Arab state and a Jewish state, there was, the West Bank did have a link to actually Jaffa here, but that didn't happen. The Gaza Strip is as a result of the first war. So what we have is we have territorial separation. Now, under the Oslo Accords, there was supposed to be a territorial link. The suggestion was from here to here. It's only 40 kilometres, so it's not far, and the distances here are not very far. And it would go through Israel, so probably a road or a or a tunnel or a bridge, which would go through Israeli territory, but you could technically have some type of bus or train that starts here, just passes through and comes here. And while it goes through Israel, it's under Israel control. It's transiting, basically. But it would allow movement in both directions, and also for goods, some type of road connection or something. And that was never implemented. So the Gaza Strip has been increasingly separated from, and there's been additional problems. In 2007, we had effectively a short-lived civil war in Gaza between Hamas and the Fatah, the Palestinian Authority, which Hamas won. And since then, in addition to physical separation, we have political separation because the two entities are not under the... We have the Palestinian Authority in control of some of the West Bank and Hamas in control of Gaza. So there's a political divide as well, which doesn't help. And as far as the international community is concerned, Hamas is a terrorist organization, so nobody speaks to them. So, for example, when the Secretary General went last week to Gaza, he didn't meet with anyone from Hamas. He didn't. There was no liaison. I mean, there's de facto a liaison, but he did. So he went. To all intents and purposes, Hamas rules the territory, but nobody speaks to them. Now, since the Hamas takeover, there's been certain consequences. One is the Israelis have imposed a blockade on Gaza, which has eased somewhat. But what it means is it's sealed off on the land side, fenced in. And by sea, at least Gaza has the sea, access to the Mediterranean. You can only go 6 nautical miles out. And then it's patrolled by the Israeli Navy. And they will fire at or confiscate or any boat that tries to go beyond that. So the fishing industry in Gaza has pretty much collapsed. We've also had 3 effectively wars since, one in 2008-2009, one in 2012, and at least the latest was in 2014, which was the most severe. So we had over 2,000 people killed, we say mainly civilians, and we had 100,000 people homeless, 18,000 homes destroyed or severely damaged. There's 2 million people in Gaza. It's one of the most densely populated places in the world. And of the 100,000, there's still 30,000 displaced 3 years later because their homes haven't been. One of the difficulties is getting construction. Well, one of the difficulties is funding, as always. And that is a problem because this is a long-term issue. There's donor fatigue. And, of course, we have other regional demands. We have particularly Syria and Yemen and Egypt and Libya, so it's not the only conflict in the area. So we've had those 3 conflicts. The other issue is that Gaza has a border with Egypt. Israel clearly wishes that Egypt would take responsibility for Gaza. They were in control of Gaza between 48 and 67. Egypt has no intention of it. Egypt has 90 million people of its own, a huge population. Lots of poverty, lots of unemployment. The last thing they want is another 2 million to be responsible for. And anyway, they are correct. As far as we're concerned, Israel is the responsible. It's up to Israel to open the crossings to allow access between Gaza and West Bank. It's not up to Egypt. to open their crossings here to allow access between Gaza and Egypt, because Israel is the duty bearer here and not Egypt. And that's because, as far as the international community is concerned, the UN, Israel is still the occupying power in Gaza. It's true they're not physically inside anymore, but as long as you control the border and the airspace and the sea, effectively you are the occupying power. So you are responsible for the welfare, and you're responsible for allowing people in and out of Gaza. Since 2013, we had the overthrow of President Morsi in Egypt and the arrival of first General Sisi and now President Sisi. Now, General Morsi was part of the Muslim Brotherhood. Hamas is part of the Muslim Brotherhood. So for that year, there was good relations between Egypt and Gaza. Since the arrival of General Sisi, there's very bad relations between the Egyptian authorities and Gaza. Among other things, the Egyptians say Hamas was involved in the troubles in Gaza. Not just, they say they were actually involved in 2013, which is a bit far. But in the Sinai here, we have an insurrection, we have an ISIS-type group, and according to the Egyptians' authorities' claim is that Hamas is supporting them, and as a result, they've closed the border, effectively. It's been closed, effectively, for the last 4 years, so it's very difficult for anyone to leave from Gaza to Egypt. And, for example, Gaza fishermen used to go down here to fish. They don't allow them anymore. They've closed all the smuggling tunnels. There used to be lots of smuggling tunnels. They've closed those. So, effectively, we've got two blockades on Gaza, one by Israel, with some easing, and one by Egypt. So the Rafah crossing here is almost entirely closed. It used to be the main access point for Gazans to leave. And if that's not bad enough, we have increasing issues between Hamas and the Palestinian Authority. The international community's position is that Hamas is illegitimate. It's a terrorist organization and it took over by force. In itself, that's correct, but Hamas did win the elections in 2006 democratically, and there was a short-lived unity government, and there's supposed to be reconciliation. So, recently, what the authority in Ramallah is putting the squeeze on Hamas. So, for example, they're no longer paying for the electricity in Gaza. There's a Gaza power plant which needs fuel, which Ramallah used to pay for, which they're no longer doing. And Gaza also gets some electricity from Egypt for the southern part, and it also gets electricity from Israel, which the Palestinian Authority used to pay for. Somebody needs to pay for it. And the PA has told Israel that they're no longer paying for the electricity for Israel, so understandably enough, Israel has cut back on the electricity to Gaza, and the power plant isn't working most of the time. So in the summer we had power cuts, or let's say for most of the summer, for a lot of the summer, it was only 2 hours of electricity a day in Gaza. So that's it is pretty impossible, and there's 2 million people living in this space. One of the consequences of the electricity not working is that the sewage treatment plant doesn't work because it needs electricity cycle. So what they're doing and what they're having, they're discharging the sewage into the sea, either untreated or partially treated, with the result that Gaza beaches were closed for most of the summer, and we had the first case of a child dying after swimming and ingesting contaminated whatever, and that's the first documented case. That was a few weeks ago. The prevailing currents are north, as we know the old adage, excuse my French, but shit respects no borders. So the Ashkelon beach had to be, which is in Israel, had to be closed, and the Ashkelon sewage treatment desalination plant was contaminated for a while. So that's clearly something that benefits no one. this. But that's to put the squeeze on Hamas. I mean, the PA has some legitimate in the fact that Hamas collects, most people in Gaza don't pay for electricity because they can't. But when they do pay, Hamas collects it and doesn't send the money to Ramallah. So, but without going into who's to blame or everyone's to blame, of course, it's the people on the ground who pay the price.
Who is paying for the 4 hours a day rate?
Well, Israel is still supplying. They didn't totally. They just cut down the PA. So they're getting some. And then they managed to procure some fuel through Egypt. I think United Arab Emirates pay for it. And we pay for some of the UN for the emergency, especially for the hospitals. Now, the hospitals are almost dependent entirely on generators. They're supposed to be backup generators, but they're working most of the time. There's a lot of elective surgeries which have been cancelled because they can't operate or they don't have enough fuel to operate, so they're prioritising it, obviously. And another thing the PA has done recently, most people who leave Gaza to Israel or through Israel are medical patients. There is a health service in Gaza. It's actually quite a good one, but it's rather run down and it's obviously stressed. Now, particularly for cardiac and cancer cases, you have to leave, and you either go to Egypt, which you can't anymore because the crossing is closed most of the time. So you can either go to Israel or you can come to East Jerusalem, and there are good Palestinian hospitals in East Jerusalem. Now, obviously, to go to East Jerusalem, you have to cross Israel. And to cross Israel, you need a permit. So who pays for it? The Palestinian Authority pays for Gaza patients if they're referred to come to hospitals in East Jerusalem and the cardiac cancer and eye. There's an eye hospital here as well. And some go to Israel, but most come to East Jerusalem hospitals. Some go to Jordan as well. Now, the PA has also been cutting back on the payments for referrals. And that's an issue as well. So we've also had cases. WHO every month brings out a report on referrals from Gaza. We have had cases of patients dying in the last few weeks because they didn't get permits or because they couldn't get referrals. There is an additional problem. Cancer patients, particularly breast cancer patients, there was a big backlog. There was a demonstration. This is back in the end of last year, so there was a bit of an increase on that. And then earlier this year, there was, I can't remember if it was the patient herself or an accompanier, because a lot of patients who come need an escort. They're too young or they're too old or they're too weak. According to the Israeli authorities, was caught at the border carrying some type of weapons-grade thing, which the Israeli authorities say that Hamas was using this woman to smuggle stuff through. That may be correct. So that also doesn't help.
They're probably anecdotes.
Sorry?
Anecdotes, at least.
Well, it's not. That was a direct accusation, so yeah. It wasn't as reported. So, and there are cases of Hamas using patients or business people to bring stuff in and out.
Right.
So that doesn't help. I mean, nobody's saying that Israel doesn't have genuine security issues. So, but that obviously doesn't help if that's the case with getting people out. So anyway, to summarize, the situation in Gaza is dire. 80% of people are dependent on some type of foreign assistance. And if it didn't have this type of assistance, it wouldn't survive. And in fact, I'll just show you. We did do in 2012, we brought a report called Gaza 2020, meaning the year 2020, a livable place, questioning if the Gaza Strip would actually be inhabitable in 8 years' time. That was in 2012. It was updated this year, 5 years later. So we've updated some of the main indicators. So by 2020, we'll have 2.2 million, another 0.2 million people, and that's the economy. The estimate for the economy, gross domestic product per capita. Now, we'll just be over 1,000, which actually is less than it was in the 1990s. The Economist brought out a report on Gaza, on the Palestine, for 50 years, and they said the Israeli economy, I think it's $35,000 per year, which is like France. Obviously, Israel is a developed country. The West Bank is $3,000 or $3,500 a year. That's the difference, which is like Egypt. And Gaza, which is this, is like Burkina Faso. So what you have is you have an African country, a rich European country, and a Middle East country, economy rather, living side by side. The employment rate is 42% at the moment. That's the official one's higher. And the prediction is it'll be higher into 2020. With youth employment at 60%, which is the highest in the world. What you have increasingly, there's a lot of people in Gaza going to university, which sounds good in itself, but frankly, the reason a lot of people go is because as you're not unlikely to get employed, you might as well prolong the thing. But all it means is that 3 years later, you have even more educated people unemployed. Health, 1,000-ish, about, these are not necessarily 1,000 doctors needed by 2020. Education, by the way, for some reason, it's not for 20, but by 2030, there'll be 900 additional schools needed by 2030. Housing, there's already a deficit of 120,000 housing units. That's the thing. But the most important or critical issue is water, because there's only one resource in Gaza for water. There's no rivers, streams. There's an aquifer. The only reason it can support 2 million people at all is there's actually quite a substantial aquifer, which actually goes all the way up to Tel Aviv, or nearly to Tel Aviv. And the problem with that is it can't support 2 million people. So it has been, the water is being extracted and used faster than it's been replenished. And as a result, the sea has been infiltrating, because of course it's on the coast, so the seawater infiltrates. And the projection is that this infiltration will be irreversible by 2020. And already, WHO says that drinking water in Gaza, only 2% or 3% is potable. By 2020, none of it will be potable. You have to either boil or desalinate. There are desalination units in Gaza, which are also affected by the electricity cuts, of course. But short of a major seawater desalination plant being installed, that's going to be the critical issue. So, in addition to the humanitarian political issues we have now, very soon, in 3 years, we're going to be faced with this critical issue. So we look mainly at the West Bank, but clearly the situation in Gaza is becoming more and more critical, with no obvious solutions on the horizon. It is a disaster, and it's going to be more of a disaster. And obviously, the only solution, going back to this, is to somehow link it. Well, you can't really say this, but if the resources are not provided, then it's hard to see. most people in Gaza, especially most young people, would probably leave if they could, but they can't. There is some smuggling. There are Gazans getting on the boats from Alexandria to Europe. But even if they do, they're way down on the pecking order. It's Syrians and others who have the priority, obviously. But there is some evidence of people, but physically they can't. The Egyptians, the last thing the Egyptians do, will open the borders because they're afraid they'll stay in Egypt. So unless there's some way of reuniting the Gaza Strip and the West Bank, then it's difficult to see how it's going to be resolved. Let's go to the West. Any questions on Gaza? There's not much to say, actually.
Do you see any outcome? What is
going to
happen?
Who knows?
It just seems insoluble.
Well, it is soluble, but it is...
require huge compromise.
It would need political will, and we don't see that happening. So I really don't know. I mean, I suspect we'll be doing reports, Gaza 2025, a livable place, because, of course, when you say it's unlivable, all things is that people's expectations and standards just shrink. So, you know, Gas could probably take 3 million people, but it'll just be a much worse place. But the issue is that it's also a question of how long the international community is going to pay for it, because that's the only thing that's sustaining it at the moment. There needs to be a political solution. And you know, going back to the one-state solution, I don't see the Israeli authorities saying, okay, that's everyone, because the one-state solution is not just everyone having equal rights, it's also having the right to live anywhere within the... I don't see the Israeli authorities saying, okay, we've given up on the two-state, let's all live happily together, and by the way, you 2 million people in Gaza can... are welcome to come and live anywhere between the Mediterranean and the River Jordan, which is why I'm saying that whatever about the two-state solution, you can query it in many aspects and the how just it is, but it was realistic, I think, at one stage. And you have to remember when the Oslo Accords were broached, probably the population of Gaza was just over a million. So, because it has doubled in the last 20-25 years.
Is there any mention of a one-state solution?
By whom?
The UN?
No, the UN, as the Secretary General said, there's no plan B. And I don't know at what stage...
Right now they're tinkering with pieces and crises.
Well, it's not even... it's been managed at the moment. I'm not even sure it's been managed, frankly. But I don't know if the current trends continue. At some stage, it will be impossible to even pretend that there is going to be a two-state solution. And then I don't know what
a two-state solution seems... awfully complex.
Well, it's not complex at all, actually.
Oh, really?
As a solution, it's very easy.
Well, geographically, it is. Land is not contiguous.
But that's why you have a link.
A connection.
And that's, it's only 40 kilometers from, even if you did it as a tunnel, from an engineering point of view, it's relatively easy. So that's not difficult at all. The logistics or the engineering of it is not difficult. It's the politics of it. But as long as Israel wants to separate the West Bank and Gaza, which they clearly do, but without having a solution to what's going to happen to Gaza, that's not going to happen. And Gaza clearly in as of itself doesn't have any future. It's not going to survive by itself. It has to be connected with some bigger... If it's
preferably with contiguous land. There you go.
Well, you could expand it, of course. You could, Israel could give some land, or Egypt could give some land,
yeah,
and that would obviously ease it, but that wouldn't solve it. It has to be connected to some other territory.
Right.
Now, Israel would clearly would hope Egypt will do it, but Egypt's not going to do it, and nor should they do it. So Israel's not going to absorb them. So the only solution is to absorb it, to link it to the West Bank, but that doesn't seem... Israel clearly doesn't want that. So, but in of itself, there's no solution for Gaza. It has to be linked with some type of larger territory. So,
does the West, you know, I'm not particularly knowledgeable about all of this, but the West Bank itself seems to be in turmoil.
Well, this is what we look at.
I mean, all that Israel is.
Yeah, well, that's what we look at. Now, this is the West Bank, much larger than Gaza, 15 times the size, only 50% more population, so it shouldn't have the same problems with resources as Gaza's. There's no link to the sea, but of course, if there was a link to Gaza, that would allow a link by the West Bank to the sea and a port, if there was this connection.
But isn't Israel effectively moving into the West Bank?
Well, that's what we'll see. So let's look at what's happening to the West Bank, how it's being affected. First of all, we have all these settlements.
Yeah.
And they're pretty much everywhere, as you can see. From the very top to the very tip of... You'll be down here in southern Hebron Hills. There's settlements everywhere.
Okay.
And that obviously physically fragments the territory. And that's just the built-up area of the settlements. So
those are all Israeli property under Israeli...
These are all Israeli towns, effectively, which have been created in the West Bank.
Have been interconnected to some extent by...
They're all linked by roads.
Roads, right.
Yes. So, and these are all illegal under international law. An occupying power...
They're illegal.
Illegal.
Yeah.
An occupying power is not allowed to move its population... It's not allowed to change the status of the territory. You can occupy it as a result of war. That's not necessarily illegal. But if you do, you're not allowed to change the status. And you're not allowed to change it physically. And you're not allowed to change it demographically.
Of course, which has been done.
Which has become... There's now 600,000 Israeli settlers in the West Bank. So it's 20% of the Palestinian population. And growing faster, because you've got member states. And, of course, they're full citizens. The Palestinians are under military rule. They don't have any access to, as you'll see when you go to the... you're going to Ofir military prison, which is a joke, frankly. It's industrialized. What basically happens is, because so many people are arrested, they just do deals with the lawyer. They do plea bargains, so they all... just to clear the system. So we have 600,000 Israelis who have full rights, who remember the difference in the economy. The Israeli economy is 10 times the size of the Palestinian economy. So they have economic advantages. All the resources are for their benefit. And as we'll see, this first there is just the built-up area. That's not the land.
The influence goes far.
Right. So that's what's built on. This is the land which has been confiscated and given to the municipalities, which is more, as you can see, particularly here, all the Jerusalem area. And then this is the land that's been confiscated and given to the regional councils. So most of the land, and this is not all, by the way, there's other layers. Most of the land in the West Bank has been expropriated using all sorts of means, laws, military order, and de facto handed over to Israel. And we don't even have the water here. It's the same water. Most water in the West Bank is for the benefit of Israel or for settlers rather than It's not a thing. You go to settlements, you see swimming pools, and nearby you'll have Bedouin communities who are not even connected to the water network and have to pay for tankered water. So the inequality is not just in terms, it's everything from allocation to resources to provision of services. There's total inequality. So that's the settlement. You'll hear a lot about settlements.
Well, that can't survive in the long run.
Not in the long run, but it's been 50 years now. In June, we marked...
And becoming more pervasive.
And becoming more pervasive and more interconnected. It's not just... Because this is just settlements. We look at other things, and they're all interconnected. So
sounds ultimately as if Israel will take over the West Bank.
Well...
Effectively,
but there is a problem. They don't want the Palestinian population. So what do you do with three?
You're damned in either case.
Well, what you do is you take the resources and you cantonize the people, which effectively is what happened. And if the international community is paying for, which they are, then in a way you've got the best of all worlds. Where you're getting all the resources from the West Bank, but you're not paying any of the price for it. So that's settlements. Then we have the wall or the barrier, which is here, which you see it? You'll see it in Bethlehem because there's a big wall between Bethlehem and East Jerusalem.
We see some of it coming in yet.
If you came in 443, it's this road. You actually came like this, so this part you would have seen. You would have come down here.
Yeah.
You would have seen some of it. Some of it's wall and some of it's fence, but it's all interconnected. So that's also changing the landscape, as you can see. And in particular, it's cutting off farmers from their land, which is a big issue. Because you need permits. That's a big thing in the West Bank. Permits and ID cards. Permits to come to Israel. Permits to cross the wall, etc., etc. I should say that East Jerusalem has been annexed by Israel. It's not recognized by the international community, but it has been annexed. And then we have all the different checkpoints and... Okay. Now, we had over 500 ops. They're not all checkpoints. There's earthmans, and we've got earthmans and roadblocks and gates, lots of gates on roads which can be open or closed or locked, etc., etc. So it's very physically fragmented, the West Bank, as you can see. And one reason we monitor it is because, you know, as a humanitarian arm, as you can imagine, this causes problems for people getting to school or to hospitals. For example, we mentioned in East Jerusalem, all of the major hospitals for Palestinians are in East Jerusalem, the cardiac hospitals, the cancer treatment hospitals, the eye hospitals. We mentioned the problems that people from Gaza have to come to East Jerusalem. But also, if you're in Bethlehem or Ramallah, you also need a permit to come to East Jerusalem as a patient. Now, they're easier to get. In Gaza, hardly anyone gets them. In the West Bank, about 80% of people who apply get them, which is better. But it does mean 20% of people are refused. And again, in most cases, they're coming because it's the specialized hospitals. So there are hospitals in Ramallah and Bethlehem.
So what happens to that 20%?
Then they have to go...
Wherever else.
I mean, there are good hospitals, but again, the best ones are in East Jerusalem, particularly, and the cardiac specialists are in East Jerusalem, etc., and the cancer ones, and the facilities are in East Jerusalem. So 20% of people are refused. That's quite a lot, if you think about it, if you're actually applying for specialized, because for most other things, you can get it in Ramallah or Nablus or Hebron. There are good hospitals there. You don't need to come to Jerusalem for normal procedures. Effectively, you are. And again, WHO monitors that. So it's better than Gaza, clearly. But it's still not anything near acceptable.
We have to leave it there as we've run out of time. You have been listening to a conversation with Ray Dolphin of the UN's Office of Humanitarian Affairs, OCHA.
This is Pacifica Radio's Letters on Politics. On today's show...
The probability of nuclear war, which I'd been trying to reduce by having a deterrent capability that would survive a Russian attack, suddenly no longer seemed zero, but it wasn't going to be started by the Russians. It would have been a first strike by the United States, which we were planning in the event of conflict with the Soviets in Europe.
Daniel Ellsberg is best known as a top defense analyst who leaked the so-called Pentagon Papers in 1971, revealing that the United States government was lying to the public about the Vietnam War. Not known then, but known now, is that Daniel Ellsberg was also a nuclear war planner who copied thousands of top secret documents pertaining to nuclear war policies. But those papers were lost during a great storm.
The other Pentagon Papers, I thought of them, but they did get lost, as you say. They were being stored for me by my brother, and they eventually, in a trash dump buried, which was hit by a hurricane, and before climate change, actually. We already had some hurricanes in New York, which I hadn't been expecting, and it dispersed the box in which these papers were, and we were never able to recover.
Daniel Ellsberg is now talking about that history, and he'll join us next on Letters on Politics. But first, the news.
For Pacifica Radio, I'm Eileen Alfandari. The battle over a classified memo on the Russia investigation took a new turn when House Intelligence Committee ranking Democrat Adam Schiff said the Republican committee chair made material changes to the memo before sending it to the White House for review. Schiff said in a letter, the White House has therefore been reviewing a document since Monday night the committee never approved for public release. A spokesman for Republican Chair Devin Nunes says the changes were minor edits. Schiff is speaking to an audience at the University of Pennsylvania about the deliberations of the committee and the memo's release.
In terms of what happened after we voted this out of the committee, one of my colleagues, Jim Himes, asked the chairman repeatedly, are we voting on the same memo that's been circulated to the House? Yeah. Well, okay. You know, is this exactly the same memo? And I remember thinking, you know, Jim, why are you asking this question? Of course it's going to be the same memo. I apparently was not nearly cynical enough to imagine that we would either be voting to put something else out completely sight unseen that no one on the committee had seen, or that we would vote to put out what we had seen, but they would send a different document to the White House.
Outside advisors speaking anonymously said Donald Trump has been telling confidants in recent days he believes the memo will validate his concerns that the FBI and Justice Department had conspired against him and believes it will discredit the probe of Special Counsel Robert Mueller. CNN is reporting that Donald Trump asked Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein whether he was loyal during a December meeting. The report says when Rosenstein visited the White House last month, Trump asked him whether the Deputy Attorney General was on his team. He reportedly also asked Rosenstein where the Russia investigation was heading. Rosenstein is overseeing Robert Mueller's probe. The Trump administration says it will allow nearly 7,000 Syrians to remain in the U.S. for another 18 months, but won't let more Syrian nationals apply for temporary protected status. The decision was a partial relief for advocates for displaced Syrians who had feared officials might end the program entirely, forcing those in the U.S. to leave or face deportation. Those same groups blasted the president for excluding more recent arrivals to the U.S. They point out that Syria remains engulfed in conflict. Only those who have been in the U.S. since August 1st of 2016 are eligible for protected status. The Department of Homeland Security said those who came to the U.S. more recently may be eligible to seek other forms of immigration relief. The United Nations Special Envoy on Human Rights in Myanmar says the Myanmar military's violent operations against Rohingya Muslims bear the hallmarks of a genocide. Yang He Lee's briefing described her recent visit to refugee camps in Bangladesh and elsewhere in the region. Nearly 700,000 Rohingya have fled their villages into neighboring Bangladesh since the Myanmar military's crackdown. Lee was asked about an Associated Press report detailing a massacre and at least five mass graves in a Myanmar village.
I do not have the details of this particular site or the village of mass graves, but you can see it's a pattern. You know, we had the Tula Toli massacre, but Indin is where the mass graves were discovered. But when I was talking to some of the refugees, a man said to me he had buried 430 plus bodies before he escaped his town.
Rohingya survivors have cited mass murders, rapes, and soldiers and Buddhist mobs burning down entire villages. Kenya's high court has ordered the government to end its shutdown of the country's top three TV stations. The government shut down the stations after they tried to broadcast images of opposition leader Raila Odinga's mock inauguration, a ceremony the government said was treasonous. Odinga said freedoms in Kenya are under serious attack, but the Kenyan people would not accept intimidation.
So the intentions are clear. Intimidation, lack of respect, because even if you want to say Raila Amolo Odinga was not validly sworn in as the president of Kenya, you cannot deny the fact that he's a former prime minister.
Odinga claims last year's vote was rigged and that he and not Uhuru Kenyatta is the rightful president of Kenya. I'm Eileen Alfandari. Letters and Politics is next.
Good day and welcome to Letters and Politics. I'm Mitch Chesrich and I'm very happy to welcome to our radio station a man who really needs no introduction, though I'll do one anyways, and that is Daniel Ellsberg. Daniel Ellsberg is well known as the top defense analyst who leaked the Pentagon Papers that revealed to the public in the early 1970s that the United States government was lying to the people about the Vietnam War. Daniel Ellsberg has been in the public eye ever since, lecturing, writing, protesting for peace. He has authored many books, and there are many books that have been written about him. And he has just published a new book that was a bit of a surprise to me, and I think a surprise to others, too. It's called The Doomsday Machine, Confessions of a Nuclear War Planner. In it, Daniel Ellsberg reveals for the first time that along with copying the Pentagon Papers, he also copied thousands of top secret documents pertaining to the U.S. nuclear program. Those papers are what we are going to be in conversation about today, though they have been lost, but we'll still talk about them. Daniel Ellsberg, it's a great pleasure to have you again. Welcome back.
Very glad to be here.
So there's this whole other set of papers beyond the Pentagon Papers.
Well, the other Pentagon Papers, I thought of them. But they did get lost, as you say. They were being stored for me by my brother. And they eventually, in a trash dump buried, which was hit by a hurricane. And before climate change, actually. We already had some hurricanes in New York, which I hadn't been expecting. And it dispersed the box in which these papers were, and we were never able to recover it. So really one of my problems in publishing this book over the years was that I didn't have the documents. But in the last few decades, a lot of them have been declassified, especially right. by the National Security Archive with Freedom of Information Act requests. So a great deal of what I had then is now documented, but not really known to the American public. It's as if it hadn't come out at all. I'm surprised by that, but there it is.
You have any idea where they are today, the originals?
A lot of the trash dump was used as fill for a condominium, and concrete was poured over them. So my brother said, now we can only get at them with dynamite, which was a joke, and I had to give that up.
Right.
I'm not even sure what the address of the condominium is.
Right. And your brother spent days, weeks trying to find them.
More than a year.
So what you have done, many of those same documents that you first made copies of,
have been declassified, as you indicated.
Yes.
Did you then go through them again?
Oh, yes. Yeah. Yes. But, you know, a lot of it is in my head. This was my life for many years before I worked on Vietnam, and which was in 64. From 58 to 64, I was obsessed with trying to prevent a surprise attack from Russia, which was no more possible, it turned out, than the use of WMDs by Saddam Hussein. Hussein didn't have any, and the Russians had, in terms of vehicles, ICBMs, intercontinental ballistic missiles, could hit the United States, had four in 1961, not what I'd heard at SAC headquarters at Offutt Air Force Base in Omaha, 1,000. And a month later, we knew that that estimate was off by 250 times. So the probability of nuclear war, which I'd been trying to reduce by having a deterrent capability that would survive a Russian attack, suddenly no longer seemed zero, but it wasn't going to be started by the Russians. It would have been a first strike by the United States, which we were planning in the event of conflict with the Soviets in Europe, over Berlin, even possibly over an intervention in Yugoslavia, over an uprising perhaps in the East Europe. Least likely, an attempted invasion of West Europe. But in all those cases, our plan was to initiate a first strike against the Soviet Union and China during the Eisenhower administration, and it turned out later. The plans were that in the event of any armed conflict with Russians anywhere, we would launch a first strike or a preemptive strike if they happened to be attacking us, which was, as I say, turned out to be almost impossible. But we would also attack China, the Sino-Soviet Pact, so-called, which had actually pretty well dissolved by 1961. But the U.S. administration was very slow to acknowledge that.
That's interesting. When we think of 1961, around this period of time, we think of the Cuban Missile Crisis.
62, yes, that was a year later. 61, there was the Berlin Crisis, and the president was advising people to get fallout shelters in connection with the defense, quote, of Berlin, that is, the initiation of nuclear war by the U.S. In connection with Berlin. The next year was the Cuban Missile Crisis, which, by the way, was really initiated, we now know, very largely by covert actions by the U.S., by Kennedy, to try to undo the failure of the Bay of Pigs invasion, which in the Pentagon came to be known as Cuba 1, Roman numeral 1. Mm-hmm. And the missile crisis, for good reason, was Cuba 2. That's the way we always refer to it. And they were closely linked because the Kennedy brothers were determined to redress that failure by covert operations in Cuba that would provoke a reaction from the Cuban government that would in turn justify a U.S. invasion. And we were rehearsing an invasion in 1962 with major exercises like the ones we practice off the coast of Korea now with the South Koreans for invading North Korea. Also, there were plans for assassinating Castro, just as we are very open now about a desire to decapitate the regime of North Korea and literally to assassinate Kim Jong-un. So he's facing the same kind of threat from the United States that Castro and Khrushchev were, because he didn't want to lose Cuba to Americans, to capitalism. And so, to prevent that, he felt he needed a deterrent against the U.S. territory itself, not just against our allies in Europe, which he did have to excess. He had the ability to annihilate Europe. But just as Senator Lindsey Graham has been saying about a possible war with North Korea, all the casualties, Graham tells us, would be over there. They wouldn't be American casualties. So, you know, not to worry about it. The president has to be concerned about Americans. Kim Jong-un hears that and feels, I think, that he needs a clear-cut, unequivocal deterrent against the U.S. itself, not just against South Korea and Japan, our allies, because those are people over there, even though there are scores of thousands of Americans that would also be victims of this in that area. So he's working toward an ICBM, which he doesn't have now, and an H-bomb warhead, which would make the ICBM feasible, even though somewhat inaccurate. Well, exactly the same basis, Khrushchev felt he needed a deterrent directly against the U.S. and not just against Europe. So he was putting covertly, secretly, medium-range and intermediate-range missiles inside Cuba that would threaten the U.S. directly to deter this invasion, this covert invasion that was being actually was being prepared. That wasn't just a paranoid fantasy of his. Problem was, yes, they could have been very deterrent once they were there and all working, but the process of getting them is very dangerous, as Kim Jong-un is confronting right now. The process of getting ICBMs may lead to the annihilation of Korea. And I'm sure he knows that, but he feels that it's worth the risk to have that deterrent. Okay, Khrushchev took that risk, and it almost blew the world up. I believe that Kennedy and Khrushchev, both of whom were very different from Donald J. Trump, or Kim Jong-un, if you like, very different kinds of personalities, leaders, everything else. And I am convinced, I participated in the planning for that at the time, working for the executive committee of the NSC in the Cuban Missile Crisis. I then studied it for a year with very high-level access, and I've pursued the study of it ever since. And I've learned more since than I knew then, because a lot has been declassified. And I'm now convinced that both leaders were determined that they would not carry out the threats they were making. They would not allow an armed conflict to arise between the U.S. and Soviet Union, because they knew that would escalate to a world-shattering event. And yet, despite that determination, despite the fact that I believe they were bluffing, and that is not the way we thought at the time, or most scholars thought for many years, they were bluffing, but their maneuvers to make their bluffs credible on the naval side, on submarines, on anti-submarine warfare, on SAC alerts and so forth, brought us within a hair's breadth of armed of nuclear war. And had that occurred, we now know the casualties would not have been all over there, and not even only in Europe. Nearly everyone on Earth would have starved to death by the effects of our attacks on Soviet and Chinese cities, that would have lofted smoke by the hundreds of millions of tons of black smoke and soot into the stratosphere, where it wouldn't rain out and where it would surround the Earth and lower temperatures here to an ice age temperature, perpetual winter, for, we now know, more than a decade. But well before that, within a year, they would have killed all the harvests, prevented any harvest, killed most of the vegetation, and the Earth's population would have starved to death. The U.S., not as fast as some other countries. We're an exporter nation, which would stop exporting very immediately, partly because we're pretty well annihilated and don't have any transportation or anything. But food exporting countries, even who weren't destroyed immediately, say in the Southern Hemisphere, would not export anymore. They'd keep it for them so that their people would be the last to starve. All this sounds very macabre. It is macabre.
Yeah.
This is, we're talking then about the possession of what Herman Kahn called, and Stanley Kubrick picked up for his movie Dr. Strangelove, a doomsday machine, an apparatus, a system designed on command to kill, or automatically in some circumstances, to kill everyone on Earth, according to Stanley and Kubrick and Herman Kahn. But in this case, it might not kill every human on Earth. It probably would not. It would probably not be total extinction. There would probably be 1% or 2% of the human population alive somewhere, probably in the south, in Australia or New Zealand, eating fish and mollusks, not vegetation, or animals that depend on vegetation. And they would survive. But most large animals, bigger than a squirrel, say, would not survive. They'd go extinct by this human action. In short, we have something that should not exist. A doomsday machine should not exist, should not be prepared, deployed, paid for, threatened. But it does. At least two of them. India and Pakistan can't kill yet all of the people because they don't have H-bombs. And North Korea can't even kill as many as India and Pakistan. If there is a war with North Korea, I believe India and Pakistan will quickly, within a year or two, 3 years, get H-bombs and ICBMs, and then they'll have a doomsday machine, two more, in addition to the U.S. and Russian. And really, no country of the nine nuclear states, and North Korea is the smallest, with perhaps 10 to 20 warheads, and perhaps as many as 60 devices, they have enough for that. Not enough for nuclear winter. None of the other eight nuclear weapon states have the remotest moral or practical political justification for having more weapons than North Korea. Actually, you can make a case, I've just made it, for North Korea to have some weapons for deterrence, and the other countries, Russia, China, the U.S., for that matter. How many? 1, 10, 20, 30? You can make a case for that. 1,500? We have about 1,500 on alert, about 4,000 operational. 10,000 on the shelves, each, the U.S. and Russia. 10,000. But even 1,500 is many times more than is needed for nuclear winter. And I would say no country has the remotest justification from any point of view of having more than a very small deterrent force and having anything like the 1,000 weapons or 500 weapons that the U.S. and Russia have. And we have more than that, of course. And the other countries have actually somewhat less than that, but still more than they can possibly justify. Israel is said to have 80 weapons. Mordecai Vanunu, my friend, the whistleblower, who spent 10 and a half years in prison for revealing that Israel had nuclear weapons and probably thermonuclear weapons, always believed that they had several hundred. And my guess is that he was right then. Now, maybe they've come down, maybe not. But how would they justify 80 weapons? Who would they be used on? What would it affect? It wouldn't cause nuclear winter, but it would cause millions of deaths. Under what circumstances could they justify that? But then we have England and France and Germany, who all have more than that, and India and Pakistan. What I'm saying is that the world is in a state here that no moral system that has ever been invented could possibly justify the existing capability to wipe out life on Earth.
Is there any strategic advantage to having thousands of missiles?
No, I would say zero. There are advantages which are, as McCain would put it or Lindsey Graham would put it, jobs. That's a euphemism for profits and votes, which is not a euphemism. Unions have supported this generally. They've supported this Pentagon has gotten very clever at distributing contracts within 50 states, you know, for a given weapon system, 20 states, 30 states. Those are jobs, votes. Now, are there other ways to keep people at work? Well, yes, but not in the short run. This is the way we do it. And so we've never converted, really, from World War II to speak of, and certainly not in recent years. We're ginning up a new Cold War. The only rationale, you see, that I can think of for that has nothing to do with strategy. It has to do with jobs, votes, budgets, service budgets, places for retired generals to go to be vice presidents, and so forth, and no real opposition to any of this, either in Congress or, I'm sorry to say, in the public. And I would hope to change that situation. The public has certainly not had it brought to their attention by anyone that what we're reconstructing now under President Obama and now President Trump is a doomsday machine.
A whole industry is developed around this, and they
around
have their
extermination,
interest.
Around annihilation.
Yeah.
And as I say, the case can be made in the nuclear era where your rivals or your adversaries have nuclear weapons. It's hard to dispute a very persuasive case that people will have the desire not to have your rival have a monopoly. And while that system exists, while there is a war system of nation states and sovereign states and not inspection and so forth, it's hard to argue for any one state to divest itself entirely if it has a rival, as with nuclear weapons. By the way, Israel doesn't have a rival with nuclear weapons, but it does have a number of states that in the large outweigh it. It actually has the military power, not nuclear power, to defend itself very strongly. But the nuclear weapons, in their eyes, serve a great purpose. And that's true in Pakistan, facing a larger non-nuclear force, and elsewhere, the North Korea, facing the U.S. And South Korea, but essentially the U.S. So there is that rationale. But I repeat over and over again, there is not the slightest rationale other than the material and political benefits of producing these things instead of producing infrastructure and education and health and so forth for having these. And they should not exist. And unilaterally, we should dismantle our doomsday machine. The Russians should dismantle their doomsday machine and NATO. And, of course, it should be done ideally mutually, and that does seem possible if you really aim at that. We've never aimed at that. And it's time for us to stop.
I have a hard time imagining actually getting to that point because it would seem like it's the ultimate sense of security. While you can annihilate all life, I get that. But having such a weapon will deter another nation from coming in and eliminating you or taking over you and invading your country.
Look, today I was looking at a post by Eric Margolis about a Russian device which is now taken seriously by our intelligence called Kanyon, which is a more or less automatic, I'm not even sure it's manned at all, but a submarine, a very large submarine, that would produce a 100-megaton explosion off San Francisco, off our West Coast and Long Beach. And it would make the entire West Coast radioactive for a very long time. And there are those in this country, by the way, who might say, well, I can live with that. But you could also have a submarine off the East Coast as well. There are people in the quote, flyover area who say, okay, well, we can live without those. But the fact is, we're talking now about the Russians producing a capability that cannot be destroyed by us in a preemptive strike, whatnot, as a deterrent to assure that the U.S. will be close, almost annihilated. And as I say, with their other weapons and hitting cities and whatnot, everybody annihilated. These two weapons actually would not, however, salted with cobalt. That's the original concept of the Doomsday Machine that goes actually back to the mid-50s, Leo Szilard and others talked about bombs salted with cobalt, which is a very long-lived radioactive isotope. This Doomsday Machine raises the question, it should raise the question to Russia, and why do they building everything else? If they have this, on the assumption, which is very rationalist and realistic, that there can be no limited war between the U.S. and Russia in a nuclear way, that is bound to be very big, and this cannot be stopped. Okay, why the ICBMs? Why other SLBMs? Why any aircraft? Why any drones? Yes, with this, they could do away, but they're not about to. Because remember, Russia now, it's capitalist. And they have the same motives that Lockheed and Boeing and Raytheon have. Profits, jobs, maybe votes. I'm not sure that Putin relies on those votes as much as our president, but he does. He campaigns. We do our best to undermine his voting in 1996 and other times, 2011, I think. They have a military-industrial complex with the same motives now that ours does. It used to be they didn't have profit, but they had bureaucratic incentives that were very similar.
Right.
That puts the entire human species in danger, both of those, as is true of their allies, NATO allies, not one and others, not one of which was willing to take part in the discussions leading up to the UN voting on a ban took place just last year. 120 nations signed up for a ban, but they were all non-nuclear nations. And not only did the other nine nuclear states boycott those discussions, but their allies did, the ones under a nuclear umbrella in Europe. And the human species has a problem here of survival. I don't think it's really likely that we have another 70 years without these weapons actually exploding. It's not, however, certain to happen. It's not impossible that we'll have that 70 years again, which is very likely now, I think, over the next 50 and 100 years and sooner. Becomes less, which I'm trying to do, only if we change policy. And that's not likely. It's unlikely, very unlikely, but it's not impossible. And my life in this book is dedicated to trying to increase that small possibility.
We are in conversation with Daniel Ellsberg, and the name of the book is Doomsday Machine, Confessions of a Nuclear War Planner. This all makes me think about this theory. I can't remember the name of the theory. It has a name to it. But in which, why haven't we been able to find any other intelligent life in the universe? Well, maybe it's because once you get to a certain level of intelligence, you're bound to destroy yourself.
Well, that's right. That's the Fermi were first posed that problem. Carl Sagan talked about it a lot. Lily Tomlin made it, remember, the title of one of her routine, her presentations, The Search for Intelligent Life in the Universe. And she had the wonderful line in that, no matter how cynical you become, it always gets away from you. And that's a very, very good observation. But it's hard to be too cynical about this situation. There is, unfortunately, a very vivid analogy to it, and that's climate.
Yeah.
What I'm saying here is it's very obvious that we have a political party in charge of all three branches of government that is in total deliberate denial of man-made climate change. So that's possible on a large scale. What I'm saying is that the world and our population's state of denial about the risk of thermonuclear near extinction is like that of climate. The nuclear winter was controversial for a while. There were doubters of it in 1980s. Now it has been confirmed. I think I'm told by scientists that there is as little controversy among informed scientists, environmental scientists, about nuclear winter as a result of nuclear war than there is, as little controversy, than there is about climate. There's really a consensus scientifically. But that doesn't mean that a large controlling part of our electorate is not capable of being in denial. And that's the same is true in nuclear winter. At least in the climate, we do have discussion of it, and it has been a public subject for many years now, thanks to whistleblowers, really, like James Hansen, early on,
yeah.
Who finally left the government and is now doing civil disobedience on the whole. But there hasn't been this discussion of the nuclear, where no one's really penetrated that denial. My hope for this book is that if it gets in the hands of other people who've been in the system, that there will be a kind of Me Too movement on social media by people who are in the strategic command, or strategic air command, who will say, this is right. I knew this. This is the way it was. And, get in there with me. And actually, there have been very similar. This wasn't Me Too, but H. Bruce Franklin just generously showed me a chapter of a book that he has coming out. And he was in SAC, showing very similar experience that he had, that I was having in the late 50s.
Daniel Ellsberg, again, this book is based on documents that you copied back during the time of the Pentagon Papers. Why didn't you release all the papers together? Why just at the time?
Because I really thought the nuclear information was more significant, than the Pentagon Papers. That was the feeling of my friend Randy Keeler, who went to prison and inspired me, really, to copy the papers and accept an almost certainty of a long prison term. But he thought, don't take time with Vietnam. We know enough about Vietnam. Put out the nuclear papers. But I said, the bombs are falling now in Vietnam. They're not nuclear bombs yet, though I thought there would be, and I wasn't wrong about that, it turned out. But, yeah, the high explosive and the incendiaries and the napalm we're dropping there now is not killing as many people as nuclear weapons would or will do, but I want to stop that. And so I thought that this history that I was putting out might have an effect on the war. And then, once it had had whatever effect it had from in course of putting it out and probably my first trial or two, then I would put out the nuclear material. But by that time, the hurricane had aborted that effort.
You never talked about it?
No. Oh, I talked constantly about the issues from the very beginning. But it was no use talking about the documents because I didn't have them. I was even embarrassed, to say, look, I lost them. And
right.
It would do no good. But I talked constantly, and I even tried to get this book, more or less, published 40 years ago, back in 1975. And I was told at the end of the war that no one would buy it, that 1,400 people might buy it. And I thought, Well, that's enough for every member of Congress. By the way, I wanted my publisher to send a copy, literally, to every member of Congress. I would pay for it if necessary. And they said, you can't really get it to their offices because of the anthrax scare. It takes months to get a book into an office. You have to send it somehow, hand it to them personally, or send it to their home addresses or something. I would like them to see it, and I would love the president to be made aware of it. Of course, he doesn't read books. But if it could be reviewed or something on Fox and Friends, you know, I would really hope to get some information to him that I'm virtually sure he has not heard. And that's just as true of Obama and George W. Bush and the others as any of the others. I don't believe, and I'm not aware, that any one of them was ever briefed on the actual smoke and weather effects of their exercising any one of those options. They could see that it would be very destructive. Henry Kissinger and Richard Nixon were appalled to discover that when they came into office in 1969, and this is on tapes, their conversations, as Kissinger said, it is the height of immorality to have the ability only to kill 80 million people. And Nixon's thought was, and Nixon said, I think the figure was 90 million, was the lowest option he had. Well, that was 8 years after I tried to change the plan, so you didn't have such exterminating options. Clearly, I'd had no effect.
And what were you trying to do at that time? Were you trying to make it acceptable to use?
No, not at all. Yeah. I was trying to make it non-automatic to kill 600 million people or 500 million or 100 million. It wasn't because I thought that 20 or 50 million people were okay. I just thought then that it's better than automatically hitting China. So I had a withhold against China. I thought it's not a good idea to hit Moscow in the first waves, which was our planning. Well, actually, it always remained our highest priority, as it was for the British and French. So what I'm saying is that what I was trying to do was actually infeasible, unrealistic. Our allies and our SAC were not about to make any of these changes. And it had nothing to do with my feeling that this would then be an okay war. I just thought maybe I can reduce. It's like somebody trying in Germany. I'm not sure that anybody did. But like somebody trying to put in half the number of Jews that were killed. Right. It would seem like, worth trying and whatnot. It wouldn't have probably worked, but I'm not aware that anybody tried to do that. Well, these, of course, were deterrent plans as I saw them, second strike plans. My desire and plan and hope was there would be no war. We would deter, but that we would deter without planning and preparing to annihilate a third or a half or all of the human population. That's what I was trying to do. I failed. And I didn't just fail. It was unrealistic to it. And my plans, had they been carried out as the Air Force would have carried them out, against military targets in cities, even when they weren't targeting the cities explicitly, but they would have burned the cities anyway, and the smoke would have been the same. So a plan that followed my absolute, I would have been very unhappy, very, very unhappy, I mean, ultimately, had it been carried out. The reality was it would have had the same effects as the Eisenhower plan, and it would have had my fingerprints all over it. That's why the subtitle of this book is Confessions.
This is when you were with Rand?
Yes, at the beginning I was with Rand, loaned in some cases to the Defense Department or the Commander-in-Chief Pacific. Later, I joined the government as a employee in 1964. But part of that was to get away from war, even thinking about wars that involved killing hundreds or tens of millions of people. I thought Vietnam is a human-sized war. And at that time, as a Cold Warrior, I thought it was justified, whether it was likely or not, because that's very ironic. In other words, I moved to Vietnam in part to get away from this. And in Vietnam, which I realized was bound to go on, and I came to realize in 69, Nixon was threatening nuclear war at that point. That was really the reason he tried so hard to shut me up after I was indicted and on trial. He was afraid that I had documents on his nuclear threats, which I was talking about, but I couldn't. I didn't in fact have documents.
I had documents.
But actually, not on Nixon's threats. I did not have documents on those. He feared I did because I knew people closely, like Roger Morris and Tony Lake, who did know of the nuclear threats and plans. As Roger Morris said, he had seen photographs of proposed nuclear targets in North Vietnam. And when he left the government over Cambodia, he did not take those with him. And as he said to me later, that was the greatest shame and regret of his life. He said, we should have thrown open the safes and screamed bloody murder, because that's exactly what it was.
Daniel Ellsberg, I want to hear a little more about Richard Nixon's threat of nuclear war, because when we think about our nuclear weapons capability, we think it's for deterrence. And you're right, that's actually a major deception.
Yes, yes.
Our strategy, our policy is not necessarily deterrence.
It is not mainly deterrence of nuclear attack. It's always been primarily and mainly a threat of first use, either in Europe or elsewhere, as in Indochina or the Middle East. In fact, I was just reading about, reviewing threats that are very little known now about in 1958, in connection with a possible invasion of Kuwait by Iraq, which had just overthrown a puppet government there. And we were afraid they would go into Iraq. And our military commanders had been delegated the authority to use nuclear weapons. It was at the time of the Lebanon landings in 58, which were really addressed to the possibility of war over Kuwait at that point. But there have been many threats like this. That's kind of the main purpose of our military forces, is just to threaten this. The first strike forces, the ICBMs and others, are intended to limit damage in the event of a large-scale nuclear war so as to back up our threat that if Russia should make second use, if they should retaliate in the most limited way, this would apply to North Korea as well, to our first use, if they should retaliate in kind, we would escalate to a disarming attack that would annihilate the other side. So all of this, and that would be a first strike too, in the sense not out of the blue, but as an escalation of an ongoing conflict by the U.S. I don't think the American people are at all aware that that's the function. You don't need 4,000 thermonuclear weapons to deter nuclear attack, period.
So you say
you don't need 1,500 either.
Yeah. You say our policy is not just out of the blue. Out of the blue, we would.
It's not been a preventive war ever out of the blue, like Pearl Harbor, you might say, not preceded by hostilities with us, but always as a possibility of preempting an imminent Soviet attack, as some people put it, striking second first, you know, before they get here,
yeah.
Or more likely, escalating an ongoing war, as in Europe, over Berlin or West Germany or somewhere else. So that's always been the main purpose.
Everyone says they don't want to be the first to do it, but you certainly don't want to be
the second to do it, obviously. And, well, Trump has said he rejects the idea of no first use. He says the threat of first use must be on the table, and you have to have the readiness for it. You can't forego that. But he's also said, I will be the last to use nuclear weapons, unless he's the first, apparently.
Is Trump's position, what he said, at least during the campaign, consistent, actually, with U.S. policy?
It is U.S. policy. It's always been U.S. policy. If Hillary Clinton had been asked the same questions and pressed, she was asked the same questions, but she eluded the questioner more or less by saying, I wouldn't change U.S. policy.
Right.
But U.S. policy is first use, just as Trump was saying. So her answer is essentially the same as Trump, and every president has done that. As far as I know, only Obama took seriously the possibility of a no first use policy. And he urged that internally as early as 2010, again in 2013, and in 2016, he's reported to have really pressed for in his last year to have a no first use policy. But his Secretary of Defense, Ash Carter, vetoed that, as did some of our allies, like Britain, I'm not quite sure why, what Britain's stake was in having a first-use policy, but I think they just didn't want any change from the current policy, which might undermine their case for having a Trident submarine, which almost by itself probably can't produce nuclear winter, just nuclear famine like the Indians and Pakistani. Why the British need to be able to starve a billion people, as India and Pakistan can, I think would not stand up to a lot of political analysis, and they don't want that discussion.
I suspect they may worry. Maybe Obama, as you mentioned, tried to make some changes, but there is this political payback in being accused of risking our own national security.
Well, exactly so, and of course that accusation is absolutely unfounded. It's like a denial that tobacco causes cancer but, you know, for many decades, the tobacco companies successfully managed to keep people ignorant or in doubt about that connection. And likewise, Exxon and others were able to keep us in doubt or denial about climate. And likewise on nuclear weapons, Lockheed, Boeing are competing, among others, to build a new collection of ICBMs, intercontinental ballistic missiles, which are vulnerable to attack. They're essentially lightning rods to attack. In the event of alarm, there's a strong compulsion to use them or lose them. And actually, losing them would make no difference in the world of nuclear winter. But the implication that, well, surely it's less bad to strike first than to strike second, which has been true, no doubt, for 1,000 years. It isn't true now, but people haven't adjusted thanks to the profitability of making new first-strike weapons.
There's this notion that we have nuclear weapons so that we never have to use them. You take that issue on in your book
it's
like having a gun.
Many people in the government, I'm sure, felt that, and I felt that. I was part of that. But Sachs, I was a little less impressed when Sachs' motto was, peace is our profession, you know, not. And actually, a later commander of SAC changed that. He said, oh, let's be serious here, you know. War is our profession. Peace is the product, as he said. But yes, but here's the problem. People can see that actually blowing up the world would be hard to justify. But preparing for it, threatening it, rehearsing it, training for it, deploying weapons for it, is acceptable on the grounds of deterrence, even though, in fact, it is creating a risk of exactly that. Anyone who said there's no chance of a nuclear war, of these weapons being used, would be talking through their hat. They would be revealing total ignorance of the situation, which is no doubt widespread. But nevertheless, anybody who knows anything about it would say accidents, false alarms, escalation, impulse, and so forth. It is not zero. So the question is, what risk of near extinction is acceptable in order to, let's say, keep Berlin or to win an election, keep a legislative program going, keep from losing in Vietnam? Well, the answer should be zero. No risk is acceptable. But that's not the American answer or the Russian answer, and it's not really the human answer. Humans seem, on the whole, ready to take a risk of a moral catastrophe, of causing the deaths of billions, in fact, a risk of that, rather than suffer various setbacks. And leaders in particular are willing to do that rather than simply lose their jobs or risk their jobs. It's what makes human survival very much imperiled right now.
You compare it to having a gun. Having a gun, the idea is not to pull the trigger. Yeah. The idea is to get your way without having to pull the trigger.
Well said. And, of course, how many people are actually impressed by the simple statistic that with a gun in the house, their likelihood of death by gunfire is actually greater, starting with suicide, but also, you know, accidental killing relatives, children. The arguments of the National Rifle Association are very similar to the arguments of the military-industrial complex. And you notice they're both very effective.
Yeah.
They shouldn't be, but they are.
What are the risks of accidental nuclear war?
Well, they're very high. I don't go into the details much in my book, For Matters of Space, but I refer people to Eric Schlosser's terrific book, yeah. Command and Control, and books by Bruce Blair and by Scott Sagan that are easy to look up, that are really very knowledgeable on this, of the dozens of accidents and false alarms and serious things, serious possibilities of preemption and whatnot that have actually occurred. And that's one of the things that the public remains quite ignorant of. I've said to my wife, Patricia, that recently, if I didn't know any more about the dangers and the risks than the public does, I probably wouldn't be thinking about this either. I wouldn't be concerned either. The problem is that for over half a century, I have been burdened with the knowledge of these accidents, some of which occurred when I first came into this problem in 1960, 61, and earlier, and accidents which persisted, false alarms, 1983, a Russian false alarm that came very, very close to blowing the world up, likewise in the Cuban Missile Crisis. So I happen to know these things, and so I'm worried.
I saw one analysis. You'll remember in Hawaii when the just a few weeks ago.
That was people were introduced in Hawaii. A million people were brought face to face with the existential situation that we really have all been in without being aware of it. Everyone, when I say we here, everyone in the world has been at the mercy of false alarms, of electronic signals and mistakes of various kinds, human errors, half the world away. Our lives may disappear, not just our own life, but everything may just go in a flash, or slower with nuclear winter. But in the case of Hawaii, missiles were on the way, they thought. Well, that was simply bringing them into an awareness that life might be over inside 30 minutes. That's been true for more than half a century for everyone. And when they talk about human error as a result of that, I would say that allowing this situation to persist is a human error, and it's based on a web, a network, a chain of human errors for the last 70 years since the nuclear era began.
I saw one analysis that suggested this is how you can have an accidental nuclear war. That the news gets out about this. And
well,
Kim Jong-un sees it. He knows he didn't send a missile. He's thinking the Americans are creating a false narrative.
That's a real possibility. He's saying they are creating a provocation here, an excuse for them to attack. That definitely could occur. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And in part because, like the U.S. and NATO, and like Andropov in 1983 in Russia, he has the insane belief that it's better for him to strike first than second. Now, that's as insane, but it's not the kind of clinically insane. It means he's like our planners and our national security apparatus and NATO's, all of which is based on the totally mistaken and especially anachronistic belief for at least the half century that it's better to strike first than second.
Is this game theory?
It's just a long-term human belief. Get in the first blow, you know. Seems plausible and natural, and in fact prior to the nuclear age made a lot of sense. But really in the first era of the nuclear age, it made sense for the U.S. There wasn't, as I've said, there was hardly any ability for Russia to retaliate to the U.S. until the mid-60s when they had a lot of sub-launched ballistic missiles and a lot of hardened ICBMs we couldn't put on. It's the mid-60s. That's 20 years into the nuclear era. Prior to that, I can just hear Lindsey Graham saying, and his counterparts were saying, the casualties will all be over there. They didn't know about smoke.
Right.
But they knew that our own weapons in East Europe and Russia would annihilate by the radioactive fallout, not the smoke, our allies in West Europe. 100 million were estimated, as in my book here at the very beginning pages. 100 million would be killed by our own weapons in East Europe, the captive nations, and Russia. Now, we were prepared by all evidence known to me, actually prepared under various circumstances over Berlin or in Europe to annihilate our allies because they were over there. They weren't Americans. Kind of, you could say, well, that's an astonishing thought. But that's 1961, when I was very shocked by it. But Lindsey Graham has been saying that this last year about South Koreans and Japanese. It's a very human characteristic that not only that people who are other, not us, not we, strangers, matter less, it's very human that they don't matter at all, in fact, when it's compared to our short-run benefit, our short-run emergencies. And I see that as a species problem, and it's why we're a danger to every other large species, not to microbes, as it happened. They'll probably survive it.
Hope so.
Most of them.
I hope so, because it's remarkable to think we've had these weapons in some form now for 70 years, I guess, if you think of go back to Japan. And I'm with you, I think. I think the older I get, I think I have a hard time believing, well, these will never be used again.
Well, I think it was kind of a miracle that they weren't up till now. They have been used in the way you described a gun being pointed at someone else
right.
without pulling the trigger is being used. And they have been used. But in terms of pulling the trigger, that hasn't happened since Nagasaki. And that's 70 years. But does that mean the risk was not great? In my opinion, studying it, you have to look at it, at the history. You can't really say that a priori. I believe that it was something like a miracle that we survived all of these occasions. It was like the Titanic at full speed on a dark night getting through the ice field and the icebergs without actually hitting one. Now, it wasn't impossible, but it really was very unlikely. And we are on the Titanic, I think, humanity, going full speed in a dark night toward an ice field. And I think our chance of getting through it is very small unless we change course or stop and reverse. And that's what every other ship in the vicinity did. The Titanic didn't. They all survived. The Titanic went full speed ahead and went down.
Do you worry about a non-state actor?
Also, that's just an addition. But it's not the only problem, as we like to think. Deterrence hasn't much to do with that, but for years, they've said, no, it's the only problem is a non-state actor. That's never been true. That was in addition to the risks. And that is a problem. It is a problem. But we're now seeing with North Korea, our own state or another state like North Korea is very definitely capable of initiating this. And by the way, India and Pakistan, top leaders, foreign ministers, whatnot, have been making nuclear threats against each other in the last few weeks that are very similar to Trump's and Kim Jong-un's. Mm-hmm. And I'll bet you haven't heard that. I came across it surfing the internet just by accident, and I was astonished. But here they are essentially imitating the same threats. And I'm not sure they're imitating. They're just doing it because they have nuclear weapons. And they're each saying, you should be aware that we're ready to use these and we're all deployed and so forth. That wouldn't lead to nuclear winter. It would lead to nuclear famine that would kill about 2 billion people, the most malnourished people on the planet, about a third of the Earth's population. There's no excuse for making threats like that or preparing to carry them out or carrying that risk. And, of course, ours are, you know, even far more outrageous. So is it impossible that we'll get through this? No. I'd have to say no, and I do say no, because I'm old enough to have lived through the downing of the Berlin Wall. And I was in 81 when I was, 50 years old. That would have been thought of, the idea that the Berlin Wall would be down in 89 would have been thought of as impossible, just impossible. And likewise, the idea that Nelson Mandela would be out of prison and president without a violent revolution, impossible. But it happened. So these changes can happen. And in both cases, of course, you're talking about mass support, but also leadership, inspired leadership. And together, the impossible happened. And that's what we have to aim at.
Daniel Ellsberg has been our guest again. Daniel Ellsberg's latest book is called The Doomsday Machine, Confessions of a Nuclear War Planner. Daniel Ellsberg, I thank you.
Thank you for having me.
That does it for Letters in Politics. Deanna Martinez is our producer. Lucille Rousseau is our intern. And Kirsten Thomas is our engineer. You can listen to our archive shows at kpfa.org. I'm Mitch Jezrich, and I thank you for listening.
KPFA Studios in Berkeley, this is Voices of the Middle East and North Africa. I am Malihe Razazan.
And I'm Khalil Bendib. The devastating war in Yemen seems to be entering a new stage.
A major base in Aden has fallen now to the southerners. Bandar seems to be holed up inside of a compound, but basically it looks as if the Hadi government has basically fallen. In Aden, which is the only place inside of Yemen that it's had any real presence for the past couple of years. If that's true, that's a very big development.
We speak with Professor Sheila Carapico, Professor of Political Science and International Studies at the University of Richmond, about the latest turn of events in Yemen and the armed clashes in the southern city of Aden. Also this week, feminist queer activist and thriller writer Kate Raphael speaks to us about the second novel in her Palestine mystery series. This one is called Murder Under the Fig Tree. Stay tuned. Dozens of people have been killed and scores have been wounded in clashes in Aden since January 28, when another front was opened in Yemen's ongoing conflict. The fighting broke out between forces of Mansour Hadi, the internationally recognized president of Yemen, and fighters from the armed wing of the Southern Transitional Council, STC, a political movement seeking secession for southern Yemen. The clashes appear to have been triggered by the deployment of the Yemeni army to prevent separatists from entering the city. Yemen expert and political scientist Sheila Carapico spoke with Vomina's Shahram Aramir about this latest chapter in the ongoing war in Yemen.
The Southern Transitional Council asked for the prime minister to be dismissed, and Hadi refused. And essentially, the Southern Transitional Council is staging what Hadi at least calls a coup against the government of his prime minister, Ahmed bin Dagher, and the resistance forces, the Southern Resistance Forces, which is the military wing of the Transitional Council, appear to have more or less occupied the city. The latest word is that last night, after bombings by the United Arab Emirates, a major base in Aden has fallen now to the Southerners. Bin Dagher seems to be holed up inside of a compound, but basically it looks as if the Hadi government has basically fallen in Aden, which is the only place inside of Yemen that it's had any real presence for the past couple of years. If that's true, that's a very big development.
Yemen's internationally recognized government moved to Aden in 2015 after Mr. Hadi and his cabinet were forced to flee the capital, Sana'a. Following an armed takeover by the Houthis at the time, the two sides involved in the recent clashes in Aden have been fighting alongside each other against the Houthis and their partners over the past 3 years. But their alliance always seemed to lack cohesion. What led to this recent armed confrontation between former allies?
There are two levels, I think. One is that there's very widespread frustration in Aden and elsewhere in the South. In Aden in particular, I mean, water doesn't run, power is out most of the time, services are at standstill, life is tough. And at the same time, Hadi himself, of course, isn't in Aden, he's in Riyadh, living in presumably some luxury. So, you know, there's widespread sense that this is not actually a government that's providing services, but rather some fat cats sitting safely in Saudi Arabia while the people are suffering. And then, you know, Hadi already in last April had dismissed the popular governor of Aden, Idrus al-Zubaydi, and some others. And then they formed the Southern Transitional Council, and things have been going downhill since then.
There were also charges, there were allegations of corruption of Hadi's government. That was one of the, I think, sources of resentment among the Southerners.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, again, he's, you know, living in what appears to be, I mean, he may be semi-house arrest, but nonetheless safety and, you know, luxury in Saudi Arabia while his country is going to rack and ruin.
Sheila, secessionist sentiments in South Yemen have always been strong, but over the past 7 years, they have been eclipsed by the 2011 uprising that brought an end to Ali Abdullah Saleh's 33-year authoritarian rule, as well as the power struggle that ensued. Later in our conversation, we'll probably discuss the history of the Southern Question, but let's talk about Southern Transitional Council, the STC, which was initiated by Mr. al-Zubaydi, former governor of Aden, as you mentioned, and Hani bin Buraik, a former member of Mr. Hadi's cabinet, after both men were sacked, as you mentioned. What is the makeup of STC and what are its declared objectives?
The Southern Transitional Council has 24 members from throughout what they're now calling again South Arabia, mostly from the east, sort of towards the Hadramaut. And they include both former members of the government of the old People's Democratic Republic of Yemen, which was the socialist government, and the colonial era elites, some of whom are kind of old aristocracy. There are three women. They formed in May 2017 something called the Aden Historical Declaration, representing the eight southern governorates and calling for the eventual establishment of a quote-unquote democratic federal state. So it's kind of setting itself up as a government. They have ministries that they call departments.
So they're not asking for separation as such. They're calling for a democratic federal state.
Well, I think it is separatist because I think they mean a democratic federal state encompassing the eight governorates, which used to be South Yemen.
So they're really asking for autonomy.
Yeah.
I'm glad you clarified that. Let's delve into this question in order to understand the socio-historical context for what is known as the Southern Question. Could you give us a brief history of the North-South discord in Yemen?
You know, historically, I mean, there was always a place called Yemen, but it was never a unified state. And Great Britain carved out colonies and protectorates in these eight southern governorates for more than 100 years. Those governorates gained independence in the late 1960s, late 67, early 68, and eventually became the People's Democratic Republic of Yemen, the only kind of socialist Marxist state in the Arab world. And that was very different from North Yemen, which had an imamate until the early 60s and later on a series of military governments with no particular ideology. And then in 1990, which is, of course, the same as the year of German unification, the end of the Cold War, the two Yemens unified. And both leaderships, I think, were imagining that they could outwit the other one. That marriage was not very happy. And 4 years later, in 1994, the Southerners attempted to re-secede, so to speak, to undo the unification accord. And the North, under Ali Abdullah Saleh, was victorious and restored unity, but also was quite punitive in its treatment of Aden and the rest of the South. So unity has been uneasy at best, pretty much since 1990.
There was an actual war between the two, right, in 1994.
Right. 1994, a civil war. It was only about 90 days. The Southern leadership basically fled. They were, I think, not good leaders. And so, again, unity was restored. But it amounted to, I mean, I sometimes, because I live in Richmond, Virginia, I sometimes... refer to the sentiments of the Southerners as viewing the Northerners as Yankees, you know, scallywags and carpetbaggers who came down and claimed the land and fired the civil service and put their own guys in power. And it was an unpleasant kind of semi-occupation for much of the South.
There is this movement, Herak.
Herak.
Yeah, Herak or Southern Movement in Yemen, which aims to restore independence to Southern Yemen. And this movement has been active and fairly strong in South Yemen. They have used the term, as you mentioned, colonial power to describe the Northern domination. And they have this South Arabian identity that has been constructed in negation of Yemeni identity. What can you tell us about this movement?
You know, it has its roots in, again, this discontent against the North since the war of 1994. And then, you know, I mean, there was also, of course, kind of complicated because discontent against the Ali Abdullah Saleh regime was mounting in the South and taking on a very specifically Southern identity and sense of disenfranchisement and anger. But, you know, there was also a great deal of popular frustration against Saleh in other parts of the country, in the North as well. But the Herak, you know, started to gain steam around 2006, 2007 as a kind of mass popular movement. So kind of leaderless, or maybe you would say leaderful, you know, street demonstrations, youth movements. And so it's been calling for some kind of independence or at least autonomy. And then during the 2011 uprising, which was the nationwide mass outpouring of demands for Saleh to step aside, that's usually in English referred to as part of the Arab Spring, it seemed as though the Southern movement and other forces demanding change, the youth movement more generally, kind of had formed a common cause to eliminate President Saleh. But that transition was so incomplete that now, again, in the past few years, the war in Sana'a has continued between Saleh, of course, who was recently assassinated, and the Houthis on the one side and the Saudi-led coalition on the other. And the South, really Aden, but the South in general, have kind of had a separate experience for the past 2 to 3 years, which is that, you know, they're not bothered by the Houthis and Saleh, but on the other hand, they're not well served by the Hadi government. So if anything, separatist sentiments have been increasing as people in the South say, you know, we just don't want any part of this mess that's based in Sana'a. And increasingly, they're fed up with pretending that Hadi is the head of a so-called legitimate government, which, again, is based in Riyadh.
What are the nexus between this Southern movement, Herak, and the Southern Transitional Council, STC, that we discussed earlier with its 24 members steering committee, as you mentioned? I mean, you mentioned something about Herak being a movement without unified leadership, structured hierarchy. How is that different from the Southern Transitional Council, STC? Is this a question of building power at the grassroots level versus focusing on capturing the state?
Yeah, I mean, I wish I could provide more clarity than I can, because I think things are moving very quickly. You have basically, you know, professional politicians in the Southern Transitional Council who are doing, you know, I think important work, but they have not necessarily fully established themselves as the leaders for the Herak, who tend to be much younger, kind of more impetuous. So I think there's a lot of, you know, negotiations and meetings and just political organizing going on right now, again, as things are moving very quickly. And then there's also the question of the role of the Emiratis, who seem to be supporting the Southern Transitional Council and its military wing. But that's also an issue.
talking about the Emiratis, in March 2015, a Saudi-led military coalition entered the war in Yemen in support of Mr. Hadi, as you mentioned, after his government was ousted by the Houthi rebels. As part of the Saudi-led coalition, the United Arab Emirates has sent a large number of ground forces to Yemen. In the recent clashes between Mr. Hadi forces and the armed wing of the STC, the UAE appears, as you mentioned, to be supporting the STC and the southern forces. Does this signal a rift between the Saudis and the UAE? And if so, what are the bones of contention?
It does seem to signal a significant rift. And in particular, it seems to signal that the United Arab Emirates are pursuing their own policy, specifically in the southern governorates, independent of the Saudi policy. The UAE appear to have basically withdrawn their support for the Hadi government, which increasingly just looks like a Saudi puppet government. The United Arab Emirates also have actual troops on the ground, which the Saudis don't. And so there have been at least some casualties among Emirati forces. Also, the Emiratis are kind of actively engaged in investment activities in South Yemen and off the coast in the island of Socotra. So it appears that the Emiratis are carving out their own foreign policy independent of the Saudi coalition and pursuing their own interests rather than the interests of the coalition.
The UAE has been financing and training armed groups that only answer to it. And according to Human Rights Watch, the UAE has been setting up detention centers and creating a security establishment parallel to Hadi's government. Last year, Mr. Hadi was reported to have said that UAE is behaving, and this is quote from the report, like an occupation power in Yemen rather than a force of liberation, unquote. Talk a little more about the UAE's interests in Yemen. Perhaps they go beyond Yemen and are more regional. And what explains its support for SDC and Mr. Al-Zubaydi, former governor of Aden?
The UAE has a number of interests. One is their oil has to go by ship through the Straits of Hormuz. Their oil is at least potentially vulnerable to a closure of the Straits of Hormuz by Iran. So they could use an overland outlet to the Arabian Sea, which would then get them to the Indian Ocean and international waters.
And Saudis have similar concerns.
Saudis have similar concerns, but Saudis can also, can at least theoretically, at least go through the Red Sea. But the Saudis do have similar concerns. Dubai has also, Dubai the port, has been in competition with Aden port. I mean, Aden is potentially a better port in terms of its geographic location than Dubai, although, of course, Dubai is way, way, way more modern. But I think Dubai Ports World wants to either be able to compete with Aden or to control Aden through investments, and it does indeed have investments in Aden. So those are two sides of an economic oil-based set of incentives. There's reason to think that otherwise also the Emiratis see investment potential of various kinds in Aden and the rest of the South. And then there's also a kind of strategic logic of countering Saudi hegemony. People frequently write about both the Emiratis and Qatar, which I'm not going to discuss too much in this, a kind of punching above their weight and attempting to counter Saudi hegemony. The Saudis clearly think that they should be running the entire peninsula. But, you know, the Emiratis have some concerns and clout of their own, and they're exercising it and looking to advance their own interest in southern Yemen.
As an example of that, the UAE didn't have its own game in Libya in supporting the groups that they picked. So what about this question of Ikhwan Muslimin, Muslim Brotherhood in Yemen? How does that play out? Given the fact that Mr. Hadi's main ally, the Islah Party, is a Muslim Brotherhood party, isn't it?
You know, it is and it isn't. I mean, in other words, parts of Islah are Brotherhood, or the Brotherhood as it existed, which wasn't really as a party inside of Yemen, was kind of subsumed within al-Islah. But al-Islah itself is not a Muslim Brotherhood. So you kind of need to look more down into the weeds of which factions for many decades. There's been a history of various Gulf governments and also individuals financing politicians inside of Yemen. So within al-Islah, I mean, there are brotherhood elements, but there are also elements that are much closer to Salafis and al-Qaeda. And so there have been various efforts by Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, the Emiratis, and Qatar in particular, and then individuals inside of those governments to patronize individuals within the al-Islah party to ensure that they have a role first in the administration of Ali Abdullah Saleh and then more recently of Abdurrahman Mansour Hadi. So those are almost like campaign financing questions, and they're pretty hard to trace.
What about the issue of war in Yemen? Are the Saudis and the UAE, are they kind of on the same page in terms of whether this is the time to end this war, for it to subside?
Our sense is that right now there's a real turning point because it looks as if the Hadi government has just lost its last foothold inside of Yemen. And I don't know for how long even the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia can continue to refer to the Hadi government as the legitimate government when they don't have a presence or the ability to govern or to deliver services pretty much anywhere inside. I mean, there are some pockets where they can, but they are not the places where the people live. This is kind of a game changer, I think.
This comes in the wake of Mr. Saleh's death, which happened in December. You would think that it would weaken the opposition, which is the Houthis and their partners.
There was a split. What appeared to have happened was that the Saudis convinced Saleh, who had been, you know, their guy for many, many, many years, they had convinced him to split with the Houthis and have a rapprochement with the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. And he basically gave a speech announcing that. And a couple of days later, he was assassinated by the Houthis. So that put his party in disarray. And now we have a split also on the other side between Hadi and the Southern Movement. So what was being seen somewhat inaccurately for a long time is two sides in what outsiders like to think of as some sort of sectarian conflict, which was always a misleading gambit. But I mean, both sides have split decisively. So Saleh and the Houthis have completely split, and now Hadi and Hirak, or the Southern Movement, have completely split.
The Saudis have been spending, by some accounts, over $65 million a day on this war in Yemen for the last 3 years. And Yemen has been described as the underbelly of Saudi Arabia by some. And it's no secret that the Saudi leadership for decades has generally tried to create a weak Yemen. So what is the Saudis' end game in Yemen right now, given the fact that, if I'm reading this correctly, UAE is trying to split Yemen, basically creating two countries, one in the south, one in the north? Wouldn't that address some of Saudi's concerns? I guess not, because the Houthis are still on their borders.
I think everyone is saying the Crown Prince, bin Salman, just misestimated what it would take to restore the Hadi government to power in Yemen, and they have failed to do so, and things are going from bad to worse inside of Yemen, which we haven't even used the word humanitarian catastrophe, which of course there is, but it's also pretty catastrophic for Saudi Arabia. I mean, it's humiliating. You know, the word quagmire is clearly warranted in this situation. It's very difficult to imagine what kind of strategic vision Saudi Arabia can salvage from this quagmire at this point. Their military mission has failed so abysmally. It's hard to imagine what they're going to try to do next.
Sheila, going back to the UAE's role, you mentioned something about the island of Socotra in the Indian Ocean. The island is a unique natural habitat, and UNESCO recognized the almost untouched island as a World Heritage Site in 2008 for its unique plant life. Evidently, 307 out of 825 plant species in Socotra are found nowhere else on the Earth. There are unconfirmed reports that UAE has been granted a 99-year lease for the island. There is a very strange arrangement. Looks like UAE has a military camp on the island, and UAE-based hotels have reserved large areas on the beaches and erected fences for future hotel development. There are also reports that land has been offered to UAE citizens who have participated in so-called investment tours to the island. What is UAE doing there?
Socotra has been called, I think, the Galapagos of the East or something like that. I mean, it is a unique natural habitat without very many indigenous inhabitants. And the UAE appears to be trying to develop it for military as well as commercial and tourism purposes. I wonder, actually, though, it seems as if whatever agreements were made to grant them leases and land and so forth would have come from the Hadi government. The status of those agreements would now be uncertain. Of course, on the other hand, it may be that the UAE is actually more or less in military control. Very unlikely, for example, that the Hadi government is in military control. The unfortunate part here, of course, is that it's a very fragile environment. And the military presence in particular with, you know, the pollutants and damages that are done by fighter jets and...
Even these future developments, they could have detrimental impact.
Yeah, all of those could very well threaten the natural environment.
Can you remind us what the role of the United States is in Yemen today? What is the U.S. policy? Is it clear?
Until today, it has been clear that the United States unabashedly and without any reservations, well, with only occasional lip service to reservations, backs whatever the Saudi government wants in Yemen. And it has done so diplomatically, by providing weapons.
Intelligence,
in-air refueling. So, you know, the United States is a party to the Saudi military campaign in Yemen. And then in addition, of course, the United States continues its own drone war against al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, which, of course, is also a contradictory policy since the Houthis were fighting al-Qaeda and the Saudis were fighting the Houthis. So the United States a little bit fighting both sides in the war. But, you know, I think the time has come now, and there are members of Congress who have called for a review of American policy of arming and supporting the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia and pretending to recognize the so-called legitimate government of Hadi in Riyadh. I do hope that somebody in Washington is paying attention and recognizes that it's high time to think through this policy a little bit more carefully.
And just to be clear, many analysts believe that the Saudi-led coalition would be grounded if Washington withheld its support.
Well, yeah, I mean, they can't fly their sorties without American support. And they certainly, right now, of course, they have enough weapons to keep it up for quite a while. But they wouldn't be able to continue a war indefinitely without American and also, you know, British and other NATO-allied weapons. I mean, that's where the weapons come from.
In a report released just a few weeks ago by the UN Children's Agency, UNICEF, the report indicated that since the Saudi-led coalition intervened on March 15, 2015, the war in Yemen has killed and injured more than 5,000 children and left another 400,000 severely malnourished and fighting for their lives. The report added nearly 2 million Yemeni children were out of school and more than 11 million children, or nearly every child in Yemen, were in need of humanitarian assistance. And there was concern about more than 3 million children who were born into this war. And these children are going to be permanently scarred by the years of violence. An entire generation of children in Yemen is growing up knowing nothing but violence. What do you think of this war in Yemen? Where do you think it's heading? Do you see an end to this tragedy in the foreseeable future?
You know, this has been going on since March 2015. And for more than a year, it has been estimated that a Yemeni child under five dies of preventable causes every 10 minutes, all day, every day.
Yes.
It's a catastrophe of incredible proportions. And in a war completely unprovoked, Yemen did not attack Saudi Arabia or anything of the sort to warrant this level of punishment. You know, we can only hope now, all the optimism has been drained out of me and most other people that I know, although, you know, there are some youth activists, young people in lots of places in Yemen who, you know, especially the kind of, you know, the millennials trying to look forward to something better and hope for something better. But at the moment, I'm kind of hopeful that this kind of last, what looks like defeat of the Hadi government will actually, you know, force the United States, even the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, the United Nations, somebody to press the reset button and stop the war.
Perhaps, you know, as you have indicated in your work, there is this civil society in Yemen, especially in the southern part of Yemen.
There is indeed. That's what I'm referring to as, yeah, it's in the south, it's in Aden, it's in the other major cities, including Sana'a and Taiz and elsewhere, you know, where there are artists. And, you know, a lot of it, of course, now has gone into things like community defense and medical relief and feeding stations and charitable organizations. But, you know, there are research groups and polling groups and Yemen Data Project and journalists. And, you know, there are people thinking about the next generation, about these poor children growing up in this horrible situation. And, you know, again, hoping for something better, not to give your audience just hopelessly depressed. The one thing I suppose that could be noted is that the worst circumstances now, mostly in the major cities, so Aden right now, Taiz, which has been horrible, Sana'a, and there are some also other areas where the fighting has been really bad and the displacement, which there's also mass displacement, internal displacement, of course. But a lot of people have been able to go out into the countryside where there's not much food, but on the other hand, there's not much gunfire either. And, you know, those are pockets of probably some safety and security for some children.
Sheila Carapico is a professor of political science and international studies at the University of Richmond and the editor of the new book, Arabia Incognita, Dispatches from Yemen and the Gulf. For more information, please visit jihadmagazine.com. From Pacifica Radio, this is Voices of the Middle East and North Africa. You can always reach us via our website at vomena.org/blog. Or send us an email at info@vomena.org. You can friend us on our Facebook or find us on Twitter at twitter.com/vomena_radio. Under the Fig Tree, a Palestine mystery, is the second mystery novel in a series by local writer and activist Kate Raphael. In it, she weaves a fascinating yarn observing life under occupation and the evolving sexual mores in Palestine. She spoke with Khalil Bendib about her work and why she decided to write a murder mystery about Palestine.
Kate, I've known you for many years now as a fellow programmer at KPFA. I've been impressed with your peace and justice activism as well, which has taken you to places like Palestine and gotten you in prison at the hands of the Israeli occupier. But I've only recently finally had the opportunity to discover another facet of your work, and this is your work as a novelist. And I must confess that I'm really, really impressed, but I had no idea how gifted a storyteller you were until I picked up a copy of your new book, Murder Under the Fig Tree. Congratulations on this, the second of a series of detective stories in Palestine.
Thank you. I'm glad you enjoyed it.
Before I go any further, what genre or subgenre would you say this fast-paced story really fits in, if it does any? I mean, I'm like you. I don't necessarily like to classify things, but as a fellow author, I know that they like to.
Fortunately, international mystery or global mystery is sort of considered a genre, subgenre in itself, which is good because I definitely don't think of these as police procedurals, even though there is a Palestinian policewoman who's one of the protagonists, because honestly, I did not do a ton of research into how Palestinian police operate. And so I wouldn't want anybody to take this as a how to be a police person in Palestine. The one thing I can say is that they're definitely not cozy mysteries. Cozies are a very popular subgenre that are especially popular with women and have amateur sleuths, usually, like Miss Marple is kind of the classic, or Hercule Poirot, and often have some kind of crafts or animals involved. And when I started, I kind of thought I was writing a cozy because they also don't have a lot of gore, and I don't like a lot of gore. I didn't think of myself as a hard-boiled mystery writer, but I later found out that cozies cannot have sex.
Ah.
And so you don't write lesbian mysteries and not have sex.
Okay.
So therefore, I am out of the cozy subgenre for sure.
One of the things I like about a good detective story, detective fiction, is that more often than not, when it's done well, beyond the plot itself, which is a perfect vehicle to drive a reader to keep turning the pages, it manages to depict an entire world the way an anthropologist might, accept much more entertaining. And your book does that very well, in my opinion. You might as well have titled it Occupation 101, except that nobody would pick it up if you had. You managed to impart an awful lot of information without lecturing or becoming too didactic. And I'm impressed how naturally you're able to do that. How do you do that?
Well, I wish I could say I did it naturally. I don't know that I did. But when I came back from Palestine, I came back with 1,000 pages of journals, some of which had been written during my time in immigration prison, and some of which while I was witnessing human rights violations in Palestine. And my friends would say, oh, you should really compile these into a book. And I thought, oh, yes, I really should. And I also thought, and no one will read it. So I tried to think, well, what could I write that people who are not interested specifically in Palestine, because there are already great nonfiction works about Palestine out there. Everything from Anna Baltzer's Witness in Palestine, which is very much like the kind of book I would write, or Pamela Olson's Fast Times in Palestine, which are from the perspective of internationals. And then there are, of course, also books like I Saw Ramallah and Sharon and My Mother-in-Law, which are written by Palestinians, which I would way rather people read if they're going to read a memoir. So I thought of this story. I actually glimpsed a scene as I was traveling in Palestine one night, and I thought it was a little bit unclear what was going on, and I thought, oh, this would be a great way for a mystery to start. I like the genre. I read mysteries. I read a few while I was in Palestine, while I was stuck at checkpoints or waiting to visit people in prison. So I had that on the brain, and I just thought, yeah, it might reach a new audience, and maybe to a lesser extent than I might have dreamed, but to a certain extent that is definitely happening.
I imagine that you must have read quite a few of these mysteries to be able to write one. I don't know how much you'd have to really absorb. I read stuff like that when I was a kid. I read a lot of it, but I would never be able to write a story just because I read so many.
It definitely took some trial and error on my part. My first draft, I have to say, I'm so grateful to the people who were my early readers for my first book, because it wasn't that well told, and it was way too didactic and also had way too many characters and too much Arabic and all sorts of other things that, you know, I really didn't know how to do it. I had read a lot of mysteries, but I didn't have a good sense of how you balance plot and characters and the internal character arcs of your characters versus what I think of as the arc of history or the arc of the Palestine story. People told me, oh, this is way too much information, or the way that you're telling this took me out of the story, so you need to weave it in. And fortunately, I had some great coaches and editors and friends and critique partners to help me with that. But writing this second one, it was a more natural process because I did know the characters already. Mm. So I could sort of put myself into a situation and think, okay, if I were Chloe or if I were Rania, what would I do in that situation? And I mean, that's the joy of writing mysteries once you convince yourself to do it, is that you get to know your characters and they sort of take over. And I mean, the best minutes are those when you find the character doing something that's very much in character for them, but not anything that I had planned. And I sort of go, oh, that's interesting. Let's see where that goes.
Okay. Yeah, that was my next question. Do you have the ability or the propensity to actually write the whole plot at first and then go into it, or do you let a little bit your characters take you places, or is it a combination of both?
It's definitely a combination. Mystery writers tend to fall into one of two categories. There are people who write by the seat of their pants. That is, they just sit there and write it. They call themselves pantsers. And there are dedicated outliners who sit down and plot everything out before they start. I learned recently to call myself a planster
because
because I do a little of both. I try to get the story written as quickly as I can because I'm always afraid that I'll get stuck. The first mystery I ever tried to write, which was many years ago, before I ever went to Palestine, I got about halfway through and just realized I didn't quite have the story. I'm always worried about that happening, so I want to get to the end and know that I have a viable killer and there's sort of enough plot twists that I can create red herrings and have clues and all of those things. So I try to get it done really fast and then go back and fill it in. But it tends not to go that way as easily as I think. I'll go off on tangents or I'll get a scene and so I'll want to write that down. And that sometimes leads to another scene. So then I just end up with a big mess. But at least I do have an outline. I just actually in November wrote the first draft of the third book in this series, Murder at the Roadblock. And I was saying when I was done, well, it's a very shaky and leaning frame, but at least it's a frame.
Hmm. How long did you stay in Palestine?
I was there all told for about 18 months, including the 6 weeks I spent in prison, but it was over a period of about 3 years, so I was going and coming during that time.
The overlap between human rights in general and LGBT rights in particular seems to have made many in the queer community quite interested in the cause of Palestine. And this is depicted in your book. In your book, Murder under the Fig Tree, one of the two main protagonists, Chloe, happens to be both a passionate anti-occupation activist and a lesbian. Would you say that LGBT people are well represented or even overrepresented in the struggle for Palestinian rights, or is that just an exaggeration?
You know, it's funny. Back in 2002, when I first went on the International Solidarity Movement campaign, we discussed that because there were quite a few queers who were on that delegation. So we were like, you know, is it just our imagination or are we overrepresented here? I think for sure, you know, queers have for a long time tended to be progressive, be part of progressive movements because of our own experience of oppression here and also because the LGBT movement grew out of the civil rights movement, the women's movement, the anti-war movements of the 60s. It was very much a product of that time, as well as, you know, Harry Hay, who a lot of people call the sort of father of the modern gay movement, actually came out of the Communist Party of the United States. I mean, there's always been an affinity between queers and the left. And even though now we have this mainstream gay rights movement that doesn't look very progressive a lot of the time, like many movements in many parts of the U.S., I would say the leadership doesn't necessarily represent the grassroots. So I do think there's becoming an affinity with Palestine, although it's not easy because especially among donors to things like LGBT centers, there are some very influential Zionist voices like Michael Lucas, who's this pornographer who is also, I think he's a dual citizen with Israel, originally from Russia, and he's a rabid Zionist. He makes these porn movies, Men of Israel or something, some of which are shot in destroyed villages. He's basically an occupation pornographer, and he gives a lot of money to the LGBT Center and other institutions in New York and has pressured them not to allow. I mean, at one point they refused to let Queers Against Israeli Apartheid have a meeting at the LGBT Center in New York because Michael Lucas threatened to withhold funding. And we here have struggled for many years with Frameline, the LGBT film festival, to stop taking money from the Israeli consulate. So it's a very difficult and complex relationship.
And gay rights are routinely highlighted by Israeli propaganda to shine a positive light on Zionism and contrast Israel for its tolerance of sexual rights with Palestine's more, perhaps less tolerant sexual mores. As someone who is both pro-Palestinian and a lesbian activist, how do you counter that narrative?
Yeah, I mean, it's something that I was very thoughtful about when I was writing this book, because unlike my first book, where Chloe's sexuality is really not a big focus of the story, although it's there and she has this relationship and they have to be careful. This book is really dealing with that issue of the sort of emerging gay underground in Palestine and queer voices in Palestine becoming more part of the fabric of Palestinian civil society. And I didn't want to romanticize it. I didn't want to present it as rosier than it is, but I also definitely didn't want to write something that could be used for what we call pinkwashing, for, you know, this project that you mentioned of Israel promoting itself as this gay haven for persecuted Arab gay people, especially because it's not. I mean, I think every Palestinian who's actually applied for asylum in Israel has been denied. I've tried to represent the spectrum of experience. I mean, of course, I didn't represent all gay and trans experience in Palestine, but I tried to represent the range of opinions and perspectives that I've encountered and that I think exist in most societies. Palestine, for sure, I mean, it's a Muslim country. It identifies itself as a Muslim country.
Mostly,
although,
yeah, although
it's not an Islamist country. I mean, insofar as it's a country, it's not a theocracy. It doesn't have a religious government. And there are minority
Christians,
rights. There's Christian population. There's a small Sumerian population, which are Jews. And they have equal rights. But it definitely has conservative values kind of baked into the culture, as ours certainly does too. But it's definitely at an earlier stage of that being confronted on a daily basis. I mean, that said, I do want to say that, for instance, Rowda Moorkos, who was really the first openly queer Palestinian in Palestine to become known, tells the story that when she came out, it was to an Israeli newspaper, like a Hebrew Israeli newspaper, and she convinced herself that no one in her village would read it. Mm. She's from a Palestinian village inside Israel in the Galilee, and she came out to this Hebrew language newspaper telling herself that people in her village wouldn't be reading that newspaper. Of course, it was all over town by noon. Her mother called her and said, "Don't come home for 2 weeks." Mm-hmm. And after 2 weeks, she went home and she's lived there ever since. And she said in many ways it's easier now because the guys that used to come on to her now understand why she isn't interested. And I was like, 2 weeks? I mean, I know people who can't go back to stock and who've been out for 30 years. I think in some ways it's a very tight-knit society, and for sure there are families that would reject somebody, but I feel like that happens in some ways less from what I've heard than it does here, because here families just in general are less cohesive and people are maybe more likely to move 4,000 miles away from their family like I did and go back once a year or less.
Yeah.
There, I mean, it's such a small country and so much revolves around the family that issues have to get resolved, and I think a lot of the time they do. So I tried to represent that as best I could, and knowing that I would do it incompletely and probably not well some of the time.
Yeah, and it's not a simple situation. I grew up in Algeria, and I saw some overtly gay people, some of them famous poets, artists, and there was a generally negative view of gays. You kind of ridiculed them and all that. But at the same time, it wasn't this what we hear about today in certain countries in the Arab world where it's a death sentence or you're really ostracized. They were not. They were just part of the community. They're considered strange. But there wasn't this intolerance we hear about these days. So it varies from country to country. And from time to time, it may be worse today in Algeria than it was when I was growing up.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Coming up next,
TUC Radio.
TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Daniel Ellsberg, The Doomsday Machine, Confessions of a Nuclear War Planner. Daniel Ellsberg of Pentagon Papers fame has another revelation to make. In 1961, he consulted for the Department of Defense and the White House and drafted Secretary Robert McNamara's plans for nuclear war. In 1969, Ellsberg copied the top-secret documents, along with those pertaining to the war in Vietnam, later to become known as the Pentagon Papers. Ellsberg's attempts to publish the nuclear war papers were stymied by the loss of his copies and the refusal by 17 publishers. They told him that nobody was interested in a book about nuclear war. The Doomsday Machine was finally published in December 2017. Now, in the context of Donald Trump's threats to North Korea, the question of what it means for the rest of the world if one or more of today's super-powerful nuclear weapons were to be used is rising to top priority. Convincing evidence shows that even a small nuclear exchange will instantly kill millions, and a larger exchange would endanger the rest of the hemisphere by nuclear winter. When Ellsberg spoke at Town Hall in Seattle on January 9, 2018, the Wall Street Journal had just published Trump's war plans on North Korea. He is Daniel Ellsberg.
Our plans that we're now considering under H.R. McMaster, the Special Security Advisor, is, quote, to give the North Koreans a bloody nose. We really do want them to give up their nuclear weapons, and to show it, we hit their missile sites, we hit command and control, we do something else. The chance of that actually ending hostilities is as close to zero as anything could be. Both sides, in other words, are under the crazy impression that it's better for them to go first than second. And if they're convinced that war is coming, or in Trump's case, that it's the only way of getting rid of their nuclear weapons, he might do it. And actually, he's not wrong about this. There is no other way, no other military solution. Let me quote one of my favorite authorities, Stephen Bannon, who has been saying throughout, before he was fired, there is no military solution in Korea, one of the reasons he was fired. Well, when he's right, he's right. It's possible to be both crazy and smart in the same head. And in fact, it happens all the time. Trump, on the other hand, if he really believes that he can, or H.R. McMaster, he can give the North Koreans a bloody nose and it will stop there, it's crazy. The theme of my book was expressed in an earlier form of the title, A Chronicle of Madness, that the nuclear epoch has been one in which very widely leaderships in both sides have believed, have held crazy beliefs as to what was possible, what was necessary, and what was justified. And they've been allowed to do that to a large extent, just as Republicans, let's say, will go along now with the idea that there is no man-made climate change. So they're able to live through what's happening in New York right now and in Boston and say, no, no, no climate change. Well, likewise, our military planning for nuclear war has been based on the idea, sort of, well, if we have to carry this out, here's how we'll do it. You know, and it's different ways of planning near extinction of the human species. 1983 was perhaps the most dangerous part, comparable to the Cuban Missile Crisis 20 years earlier. And we didn't even know that. And the reason was that the then Soviet leader, former KGB head, Andropov, had become convinced that the U.S., Reagan, was planning a first strike against the Soviet Union. Now, Reagan was not. That was absolutely wrong. But what could have given that clue, that idea? How could such an... Reagan himself was astonished when he was finally convinced by a defector that Andropov really had feared that, and that his reaction, his actions in part were in response to that fear. How could he have imagined that? Well, Reagan was conducting the largest, fastest buildup of nuclear arms since John F. Kennedy. We're now involved in the third such buildup now. But Reagan's was a $1 trillion buildup like that. Second, Reagan, to put the Soviets off guard, was doing exercises off the Soviet coast and sending reconnaissance planes even into Soviet airspace, testing their defenses as if preparing for an invasion. This was very secret. Almost nobody in the government knew that he was doing that. When they saw Russian reactions, such as the shoot-down of KAL-007, the Korean airliner, hardly anybody realized that that followed actions of penetration that had been happening and that they confused that with a military reconnaissance plane at that time. Third, we had a president who regarded the Soviet Union as an evil empire, as he said openly, and one that should be eliminated, essentially. He even joked at a microphone on one occasion, which he didn't realize was an open microphone, and he was just testing beforehand, and he said, the Soviet Union has been banned, the bombing will begin in 15 minutes. Reagan was batting down the idea of a nuclear weapons freeze, of the kind of freeze word that's come out recently in connection with North Korea, stopping exercises on our part, stopping testing on their part. Well, the idea of a bilateral nuclear weapons freeze, with no more nuclear weapons, which I was a big part of, had to be batted down by Reagan very, very hard. He was putting first strike weapons like Pershing II into East Germany with an ability to hit Moscow within minutes. And finally, this just came out within the last year, almost 30 years later, that they had gotten from a defector, from a spy, a very super secret, higher than top secret, plan in NATO for the decapitation of Soviet command and control. Did you know this, or have you followed this? Which scared the hell out of them. As I say, this only became available in the last year, that they had this plan for cyber warfare, basically, and for hitting various command and control points, which looked exactly like a first strike plan that we might think might work. So here we had gotten Andropov into thinking that we were preparing to use an exercise, which was a nuclear weapons exercise in Europe called Able Archer, would be the cover for an actual surprise attack. And he had a huge intelligence thing going on. To this point, A, it's exactly like the present, both with respect to Russia and North Korea. And B, one little factor in here, Andropov, the KGB former chairman, and now the prime minister, the president, believed that Reagan was crazy. He wasn't the only one who thought that, actually, to remind people at the time. And just a little footnote right now, it's in the news this week, more that Reagan was showing evidence of Alzheimer's in the White House, and which, of course, later became very evident. But he regarded him as crazy. We have an open discussion going right now of whether we have a crazy president or not, or whether he's only pretending to be crazy, and whether that makes a difference, all of that. All of it leading up to the notion that they fear that this person might actually launch a surprise attack, okay? All that is similar. And now, what no one has commented on this crisis, I take it you've studied it, the Able Archer and so forth, nobody comments on the fact that Andropov's readiness to respond to that was to preempt the attack, to move first. Go second first. Don't wait for the first one to go. Don't do like Barbarossa in World War II, where Hitler's armies captured millions and millions of Russians with a surprise attack. No, go first in a nuclear era. But that's insane. That's insane. Go first? The world ends when you go first. When did we learn that? 1983. That's the year of Able Archer. In that year, Carl Sagan and the others came out with the news for the first time that the smoke from burning cities would be lofted into the stratosphere by firestorms. And here we were asking whether history repeats itself. In World War II, we were only able to get firestorms going three times mainly, though there were two other rather very small firestorms at Hamburg, Dresden, and Tokyo. And a firestorm is a very special kind of a fire. You have to have simultaneous fires over a widespread area, which create updrafts from low pressure zones. Then in the heated air rises and bring in winds, either in a rolling conflagration across, if there's a ground wind, or from all sides, creating temperatures now that are enormously high, 1,500 degrees Fahrenheit, 1,200 degrees in some cases, 1,500 in others. Temperatures you don't get under any other conditions except a nuclear weapon. Hiroshima created a firestorm, but nothing between Tokyo on March 9th and 10th and Hiroshima on August 6th created a firestorm. That's why they only killed 900,000 people, of whom 100,000 were on one night, because that was the firestorm. Now, what they discovered was, in 1983, the smoke from the burning city will be lofted by the firestorm, the force of these updrafts, into the stratosphere where it doesn't rain out. And it goes around the globe very quickly, obstructing sunlight for what we now know is more than a decade. Perhaps 70% of sunlight would be obstructed. This is assuming many cities, hundreds of cities being hit simultaneously, which would happen in our plans or Russian plans. Okay. The harvests would all be destroyed. There would be no harvest, very little vegetation left, and nearly everyone would starve on Earth. Nuclear winter, not only a matter of the lakes freezing and the rivers freezing and terrible cold and drought, whatnot, but the death of the harvest would mean that the world food supplies of about 60 days, it would take longer than 60 days for the U.S. because a lot of it is concentrated here, so we wouldn't export it anymore. So the people who rely on exports of U.S. food or Chinese soybeans, whatnot, They starve first. We starve later, within a year. Now, that's what's being threatened, though, by any initiation of nuclear war. That was discovered in 83, but Russian scientists, Svinchenkov and some of the others, had discovered it a little before ours did, 82, 81. Gorbachev referred to this. So Andropov's plan of preempting the attack, was he crazy? No one ever said Andropov was crazy, but this was a crazy plan. It was exactly like ours all this time. And the idea of preempting. Right now on North Korea, nuclear winter is not at stake. Of nine nuclear states, only one cannot blot out enough sunlight to starve at least 2 billion people. The Indians and Pakistanis can do that. The others can do more. North Korea, whether it has 20 or 30 or 60 weapons, can't cause nuclear winter. And they don't have enough cities there for us to loft that much smoke. But what would be involved is the death of several million people, more in one day or a week than has ever been seen in the history of the world. See, the biggest, number one, is Tokyo, 100,000, 80 to 120,000. This would be several million within a day or a week. Bigger than ever, but not nuclear winter. Not a good idea for North Korea. If North Korea thinks it's a good idea to start a war with the United States, wrong. That would be wrong. On the other hand, if he has made provision to assure nuclear response to his being killed, Kim Jong-un, that's like every other ruler pretty much on this. You know, Hitler was willing to see Germany burn to the ground if he was going to get killed. I would say that ideas of decapitating Kim Jong-un are as reckless and murderous and, you know, as they could be. But come back to Andropov. Andropov was not Donald J. Trump. And yet, his plans were to preempt. I haven't seen anyone comment on that. No one. He said, and by the way, this plan, because it's so familiar, it's a SAC plan, a strategic air command. That's what we would do, with the same effect. Exactly. So we are building now another $1 trillion, perhaps $1.6 trillion, in allowing for inflation, in the next 30 years, for weapons to do exactly this, to preempt an attack with this effect, right? So I'm saying that it's a craziness altogether. And in answer to your question, does history repeat itself? It hardly changes. It just goes on. Okay.
All right. So, Dan, I have a one-sentence question about the increasing automation of military operations and warfare. By the way, Peter Lumsdaine from the Ground Zero Jeep Action in Nevada back in the 80s on the Vandenberg MX campaign. So my question is, how do you think that the rapidly accelerating rise of corporate military robotics and artificial intelligence affects the challenges and resistance strategies for the human race in this century?
There is talk now of automating drone warfare almost entirely, you know, under automatic intelligence. Under Obama, the rules of engagement were raised for the drones at one point, and I think it was under Petraeus in particular in Afghanistan, to allow drones to attack anyone who fitted certain profiles of movement or of communications in various things. They didn't have to be any intelligence specifying them. They didn't have to be carrying special weapons or uniforms or anything else. But if they acted in a certain way, if they communicated in a certain way, hellfire missiles come down and hit wedding party after wedding party after wedding party and funeral parties. And then when people come out to the funerals of the people who've been kidding before, they get hit too because they're a convocation of vehicles in the desert. What are they doing all together like that anyway? So this is horrible, but that's what happens. Well, you can automate that pretty easily. You know, if you have a set of criteria for launching the criterion, that's all it takes. In fact, at one point they said any male between, 14 and 40, something like that, is to be enemy combatants. Well, A computer can figure that one out. So you can automate that. In the book, I quote, going back now into the 50s, General Cooter, who was at one, had various jobs, but at one point he was head of North American Air Defense Command, at other times Pacific Air Command, was saying to Herb York, I think at that time he was still director of Livermore Lab, later under Kennedy was research and engineering. So he tells that they were just starting on ABM work then, and he said, anti-ballistic missile, and he said, you know, the timing is so fast there, the missiles are coming over, you can't wait for human decision. You know, you've got to automate this link and this link and so forth. And Herb York was sort of going along with this up to a point. And then he said, of course, eventually we get it to the point where it's entirely computerized. And York says, you know, they'll recognize it, they'll go against it. Okay, so Cooter says, but eventually we'll get it so it's totally automated. And York says, oh, no, we're never going to do that. And he reports, Cooter looked at him and said, well, we might as well surrender right now then. And so the answer then on AI and artificial intelligence, I believe, is there are many people who do not shrink from the idea of a Terminator-type warfare, you know, world in which the computers are waging war with us underneath. Yes, this does have to change. Since I've mentioned York, I want to mention one other thing. There are two major nuclear design labs, both of them campuses of the University of California. All of our nuclear weapons, from the atom bomb, first ones, Fat Man, Little Man, to the neutron bomb, to everything else, have all been designed at an American university, one university, the University of California. But anyway, York went back to Livermore and said, I've asked myself how many weapons it takes to deter someone rational enough to be deterred. So what would you say? Any candidates here?
I'm hearing one.
One? Well, that's what York said. One. He said one, but maybe you'd say you needed a few more, you know, in case they thought they could get the one, or one city they might be willing to sacrifice, something like that. Maybe 10. And then he went at it from another point of view. He said, what's the largest amount of destruction you would want one man, one person, one woman, to be able to inflict in a brief period of time? Is there some ceiling on that, or is there a too much? And he said, how about the total casualties of World War II, 60 million? Maybe the ability to kill 60 million people in a week or so should be the limit for what somebody can control. He says, well, that would take about 100 weapons, 100 kiloton weapons. He said, you could calculate, it might get up to 200, but not, probably not. It would be 100 or less. So he said, the number needed to deter nuclear attack, which, by the way, Judith, is where I started. You know, how do we deter this attack? The number needed would be, quote, 1 to 10 to 100, but closer to 1 than 100. He says, okay. That would mean, by the way, 49. If North Korea has 60, which they probably don't, it's probably less, that's more than you could justify on this ground. Every other nuclear weapons state has many more than that. When Eisenhower came into office in 1953, we had 1,000 fission weapons, the type that destroyed Nagasaki, only most of them more powerful by that time than Nagasaki, but fission weapons, 1,000 that Truman left. When Eisenhower left office, we had 23,000, mostly thermonuclear weapons. The earlier thermonuclear weapons used Nagasaki weapons, need Nagasaki weapons as their detonator, as their percussion cap, as their fuse, you might say. The earliest of our H-bombs, it's easier to make a big one than a small one, actually, were 1,000 times more powerful than the Nagasaki. So we had 23,000 of those. Eventually, in 1967, under Johnson, see, I was in Vietnam in 67. In 67, We had 37,000 nuclear weapons. The Russians had close to 40,000 at that point. At the height, there was a total in the world of about 67,000 nuclear weapons. Come back to Herb York's point. 1 to 10 to 100 and closer to 1 than 100. Is it desirable to keep North Korea from getting an H-bomb and an ICBM? Yes. It was also desirable that Pakistan not get them and that India not get them, et cetera, et cetera. In fact, all of the others, in effect. Would that be the end of the world? Or is there any reason to believe, by the way, that North Korea would use those weapons against the U.S. out of the blue, unprovoked? Actually, no reason. Is it impossible? No, I wouldn't say it was impossible. He could have a false alarm. He could go crazy, something like that. It's definitely desirable he not have them. Are there ways of keeping him from getting them other than attacking? Probably yes, according to the people who know North Korea best. You'd have to have a peace treaty with North Korea. We don't have one since the Korean War. Lower or drop the sanctions. You'd have to stop exercising assassination and invasion. That doesn't seem impossible demands somehow. Well, that means we give up regime change. How can you give up regime change just because they're another country and aren't, you know, not a state of the United States? Well, since Iraq, we've talked about regime change, which is the definition of empire. A country that believes that it has the right and the power and the readiness and the intention to determine who rules another country. And we are, in fact, a covert empire, in my opinion. Covert in the sense of plausible denial, meaning the fact that we are an empire, that we have this determination to decide who runs this country and that country, is covert. We deny it plausibly. Why plausibly? Well, our people are educated to think, well, that's not us. That's not who we are. Actually, it is who we are, but we deny that. It's He said, and moreover, the means are covert, assassination, bribery, paramilitary, coups, and whatnot. So it's a denied empire, pretty much. If we gave that up, we would have a good chance of keeping North Korea from not moving ahead with ICBMs. That would be good. The military alternative is the almost certain death of several million people. Mostly over there, our allies, mostly South Korea and Japan. I would say the current situation calls for the highest degree of one can imagine. I can't imagine what would be too much non-violently and truthfully to do, to convey to Congress, but above all to the executive branch, there must not be an attack on North Korea. That should be heard in letters to the editor. It'd be heard in town hall meetings like this. Thank you for raising the question. I apologize for not raising it earlier. But I would put it the highest priority, avoiding a war with North Korea. And keep in touch with that in a way you couldn't do years ago. But now it's possible on the internet to find out a tremendous amount is leaking out, to be sure, to the rage of Trump. I can certainly say, by the way, that if someone in the administration, there must be hundreds of people, thousands of people, who have access to estimates in the administration that officially tell that not all the casualties would be over there, and that the casualties over there are absolutely intolerable. That's not the word that would be used officially. They would just say millions. By the way, it's not only that the effects of this war would not only be measured in casualties, in my opinion. And let me take 1 minute on that, because I believe we are in a crisis right now, not unlike the Cuban Missile Crisis or the 83 crisis, except in scale. We're not looking at the end of the world, but beyond the casualties. If there is an attack on this country in retaliation, which I would think is not certain, but highly likely, democracy is pretty much over in this country, I think.
Daniel Ellsberg, recorded by Mike McCormick at Seattle Town Hall. on January 9, 2018. Ellsberg was on stage to discuss his new book, The Doomsday Machine, Confessions of a Nuclear War Planner. In 1961, he consulted for the Department of Defense and the White House and drafted Secretary Robert McNamara's plans for nuclear war. Even though Ellsberg's prior book, The Pentagon Papers, became world famous, he had a very hard time getting a publisher for a book on nuclear weapons. However, the attitude now has changed as Donald Trump is putting out tweets calling for the annihilation of North Korea. The full talk is over an hour long, and you can watch it for free online at Mike McCormick's Talking Stick TV. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look at the newest programs or the podcast page. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening.
Listening to Unusual Sources here on 93.3 CFMU FM. That was Billy Bragg, Upfield. Maybe you'll hear a little more of that later. But today here we have a special program. We've brought in Henry Evans Tenbrink, who is a well-known activist here in Hamilton in the larger area. Henry has been involved in so many causes, we wouldn't be able to list them here. He's done a lot of work on Palestine as a solidarity activist. He's been to Palestine, in fact. He can tell you all about that. And he's done a lot of work back coming in Canada to raise awareness about the occupation. But like our co-host Doug Brown, Henry is also a longtime member of the NDP and the trade union movement, has been at many pickets and rallies to defend labor rights and to protect things like our postal service, having been a lead campaigner for that in Canada. So what we wanted to do today is there's an upcoming convention with the NDP. It's an important convention. It helps to set the direction of that party. And this comes at a time when social democratic forces are in resurgence in some parts of the world, when people are starting to talk again about having a left, an organized left. And in Canada, we don't have much of that, of course. There's a lot of work to be done. And there's a lot of grassroots activists on the ground that are propelling things forward. So Doug Brown, of course, he's not just our co-host, but he's heavily involved in all sorts of issues here in transit, in Burlington, in Hamilton, in the NDP, and in many anti-war causes and nuclear disarmament. So Doug and Henry have a lot of experience in the same kind of issues, issues that concern this program and our audience and this community. Some of us are going to be at this convention, and there's been a lot of preparation underway. I better hand things over to Doug because there's been a lot of talk and work on this issue. So, Doug, I'll let you bring in our program today with Henry.
Okay, great. Well, thanks, Brendan, and welcome, Henry. It's really great for you to have you here. And, you know, the world's in a precarious state. I mean, the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists just moved half a minute closer to midnight. You know, tensions are rising. There's this open threat of war and genocide against North Korea. The continued Russophobic attacks on anything and everything that Russia could or would or isn't involved in. And, you know, so this is a time really for progressive voices within the NDP to be heard and take a firm stand for peace and justice. And I think perhaps the NDP would say, well, we're for peace and justice. But when you go issue by issue. We're not. There's very significant exceptions to this. And, you know, Henry, you and I were in Edmonton at the last policy conference.
Yes, we were. Yeah.
And, you know, we attended, well, we tried to get resolutions on the floor. And I found it a very frustrating exercise. Tell me what your take was of what occurred in Edmonton.
Well, thank you for having me here, Doug and Brendan. And yes, it was extremely frustrating. As you mentioned, Doug, we did try to bring resolutions to the floor. One of the resolutions I had put forward was actually introduced as number 52. And we did manage to get it moved up to number 9, but even so, it didn't get on the floor. And issues like something that happened 100 years ago made it, you know, in the top three that has absolutely no significance today other than, you know, the people did deserve an apology for what happened. But, I mean, still, there are issues that are so important today that were ignored. As you're aware, 84% of the NDP grassroots and 63% of Canadians as a whole support Palestine in their fight for justice and to end the occupation. And yet it seemed that the leadership in the NDP in Edmonton did everything they could to avoid having that come to the floor.
Right. And, you know, I recollect that I believe you were the first one. You got there early for the prioritization of resolutions on foreign affairs.
That's
and,
right.
And I know you got to the mic first and you made a plea to move up your resolution. I would say our resolution, because there are a number of writings had sent similar resolution in you know for justice for Palestinians and to have a policy supporting BDS and other peaceful means of putting pressure.
And when you say my resolution, Doug, it was actually I put the resolution forward, but it was a resolution that was endorsed unanimously by the Hamilton Mountain NDP riding.
Yeah, and also in Burlington and a few other riding associations that also endorsed it. So you know, you did on the ground. You were fantastic. Got to the mic first, so they couldn't block you. But I got to the mic. I think I was fifth in line. I never made it because they stalled, and they, you know, and brought in extraneous arguments and other issues. And you know, before we knew it, it was over. And really, nothing significant had happened because of this this strange debate that was going on. You know, like whether the resolution on Palestine should be put behind certain other resolutions and so on and so on.
Well, if you recall, Doug, even when it, you know, our resolution was about to come to the floor and a fellow stood up and started speaking on issues that had nothing to do with what was being discussed, totally skewed the direction of discussion and so ensured that the resolution never did get to the floor.
Yeah.
So if I understand what's happening here, you came very prepared to engage in discussion at this previous convention about Palestine and the occupation and the NDP's approach towards that issue. And it looks like you're dealing with stalling tactics being employed. They don't want to confront these issues.
Yeah, exactly. In fact, it wasn't just the resolution on Palestine. Several riding associations had put in resolutions to have the party oppose the arms sale to Canadian arms sale to Saudi Arabia. And they rank that like rock bottom.
Yeah.
So there were a lot of good resolutions that were ranked very low. And yet we had like a resolution for the NDP to take a stand against torture. Well, I thought, you know, that's like motherhood. We don't need to spend time debating whether torture is good or not. Everybody is against torture. But it was a stalling tactic so that more substantive issues wouldn't come to the floor.
So this ranking system, it sort of determined what would even make it to the floor and be discussed in the first place. So a lot of the things you wanted to talk about just were put right at the bottom so we could never get to it.
Yeah, there were 54 resolutions, and we knew that probably only four or five would ever reach the floor just because so little time is allotted. I did have a discussion much later with somebody that was on the resolutions committee, and I was told, well, our criteria was that they not be controversial, and I said, well, it's the controversial ones that need debate.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. So, well, and you know, for example, you know, and I mentioned that one of the resolutions that came up was from over 100 years ago where and don't get me wrong, this is an important issue, and I think the community did deserve an apology for it and that it should have been addressed, but not at the expense of issues that are taking place today. And that issue was a ship that was turned away with passenger list.
Kamamaru.
Yeah, yeah. Of Sikh immigrants.
Yeah.
And, you know, they suffered greatly because of that decision. And so it was a wrong decision for the government to make at the time. But still, you know, that was 100 years ago. And we were dealing with issues that are taking place today. You know, people are dying. People are being wrongly incarcerated. And it needs to be dealt with. You know, resolutions that are being put forward by the UN are being ignored, and yet one of the criteria, you know, with the Americans going into Iraq, for example, was that Iraq was ignoring two UN resolutions, and whereas Israel is ignoring hundreds of resolutions dealing with Palestine.
Yeah. So, you know, the experience of a couple of years ago, the Edmonton Convention was quite – we didn't really deal with anything substantive on foreign affairs. In fact, you know, to see another hot issue, it should have been a hot issue for that convention, the arms sale to Saudi Arabia being ranked so lowly, at least Stephen Lewis, who was one of the keynote speakers, covered it a bit, you know, expressed some dismay that it would not get discussed. So I think we have a long way to go for the NDP. We're, in serious need of you know, developing good and fair foreign policies that the party should be putting forth.
I agree. And, you know, I think part of the problem, Doug, is that the Canadian government, and that's you know, all three parties are guilty of this, is they're afraid to anger the Americans, you know, to the south of us by going against their policy. And a good example, you know, of what's happening there was in last night's State of the Union speech, where Trump came right out and said that they want to deal with countries that voted against their policies. So any country that doesn't support American policy is declared an enemy of the Americans, and you know.
Yeah, well, see, this is exactly what we need to confront, and this is exactly what we need the NDP for. We need a third party because you have a situation right now under the Trudeau government where you have Trudeau and Chrystia Freeland, and they'll say, we oppose Trump. Oh, you know, we're against that bully and that barbarian, you know, to the south, and they'll make a big show about how progressive they are, but Trump's foreign policy is our foreign policy. If Trump says we're going to go after Korea, Canada's foreign policy is we're going to go after Korea. If Trump says let's put more soldiers on the border with Russia, then, yeah, that's going to be Canada's policy too. And although both Freeland and Trudeau have made statements about how they're paving the way for multicultural, global, whatever, and liberalism and so on, it is Trump's foreign policy that they are executing. And we know that the liberals are going to do that. We know that the conservatives are going to do that. What about the NDP? Can the NDP present some kind of alternative policy. And it's a critical question because, of course, the NDP used to have it in their policy that things like get out of NATO, Canada should not be part of NATO. And that was reflecting the powerful peace movement of the 1960s, 70s, 80s. And, it became a part of that manifesto. And there's been a move away from these kind of things, which means they're moving away from the things that differentiate themselves as a party from the other two parties.
Exactly. And part of the problem there, too, is we've seen the NDP evolve to a position where at one time it was our policy to get out of NATO, to get out of NORAD. And those policies have been removed without input by the grassroots. The feeling with the majority of I'm sure Canadians and the NDP is that we should pull out of NATO and NORAD. Part of the problem also is that people are misinformed about the role of NATO as opposed to the role of Canadian forces in UN peacekeeping. I saw this at a CUPE convention where a resolution came to the floor to get out of NATO, and people came up and said, well, Canada, NATO is part of the peacekeeping forces. They enforce peacekeeping, which is not true. NATO is part of the American enforcement of American policy. Well, yeah, that's all they do.
That's the only reason why it exists now. I mean, allegedly, it was formed to counter the Soviet Union. It formed before the Warsaw Pact, and it existed in order to protect Western Europe from Soviet invasion. Well, the Soviet Union dissolved in 1992, but NATO did not and has, in fact, expanded, just as the U.S. has not left South Korea, it's not left Germany, it's not left those Pacific Islands. It stays put on its web of military bases, and NATO stays put and expands. And right now, NATO is looking for a reason to exist, and it's found one with Russia, and so it's pushing towards greater confrontation and greater escalation of the situation, rearmament, arms buildup, and so on and so forth. You know, is this the kind of policy Canadians want and that we want to get into, and you know, that the NDP represents?
Exactly, Brendan. And in addition, when you mentioned that the Soviet Union dissolved, I mean, when it dissolved, part of that was NATO and the Americans promised that they would not move into previous Warsaw Pact countries, and now we're seeing American bases formed. They pretty well got Russia and China surrounded with American bases now, and so given the history of Russia, they lost over 20 million people during the war. They were the country that suffered the most, actually. As a result of the Second World War, and they made a promise to themselves that would never be allowed to happen again. And so now American military policy is they're moving into these Warsaw Pact countries, and Canada is complicit. They've got a base in Latvia now. I think it's about 400 troops, and they're supposed to be a wall to prevent Russian invasion. Russia has been a relatively peaceful country. They've not invaded other countries. They don't have bases set up all over the globe. And yet the Americans declared them as an enemy. And the only reason they declared them as an enemy is to justify their arms buildup, as you said. The industrial military complex needs a reason to produce weapons. And this is their excuse. They've declared Russia an enemy. North Korea, which is never invaded another country, has been declared an enemy. The only reason they have their nuclear arms is to deter the Americans from doing to them what they did to Libya and to Syria and to Iraq. And the propaganda has people believing that these countries are a threat when in actuality they've never been a threat.
And, you know, there's, I think, an image of NATO that, you know, where Canada joins with a lot of other countries in this collective exercise. But NATO doesn't vote on things. It's a consensus. And the U.S. forms that consensus. I cannot think of a significant issue where NATO has ever gone away from U.S. Foreign policy objectives. And so if we want an independent foreign policy, Canada really has to get out of NATO. And that would be a breathtaking step because no country has ever left NATO. Which I think says something about the structure of NATO as well. But through NATO, we've had to, like we bombed Libya, a country we have no dispute with at all. And we bombed Yugoslavia. So we should be independent, like the Irish model, independent foreign policy, do what's right and don't be bossed around by the U.S.
Mm-hmm. And we see in Syria, for example, where American policy failed. They attempted to get rid of Assad, the Assad government, and they demonized the Assad government with propaganda. That's not true. A good friend of ours, Eva Bartlett, was in Syria and reported back as an independent journalist and proved that the propaganda that was being fed to us by the Americans and by our own Canadian government was not true. And recently she was also in North Korea. And from her reports, the things we're hearing about North Korea are absolutely, on the whole, false. I believe she met with two American soldiers who said that, they were there to recover bodies from the Korean War. And they said that everything they heard about Korea has turned out not to be true.
Yeah. Well, you've got a situation where, a handful of people can shine a light on a situation better than, much of the established left or, whatever. So it kind of hints at a larger problem here that we're getting at, in that there is considerable dissent or dissension in the ranks, I guess you might say, about a lot of the policies Canada's pursuing and about the direction we're going in. At the same time, there's growing strength of certain movements, such as the Palestine movement, for example, which has been growing within the NDP's base itself. When is the party going to represent these frustrations and also these new growing movements? They seem to be hiding from it as a strategy, which is not a strategy. And I know you want to talk about Palestine and some of these other movements and things that are going on in the ranks. So I'll let Doug talk about that.
Well, okay. So in just a couple of weeks, we have the convention in Ottawa, NDP policy convention. Henry and I are going. Yeah, a number of people from local riding associations are going. We've had discussions. I know Hamilton Mountain, and you had a big role in this, Henry, amazingly good resolutions on a number of foreign policy issues, including Palestine. Same in Burlington. We got some good resolutions. I think most of them are pretty well identical to the ones passed in Hamilton Mountain. So here's an opportunity to see if we can start a process of changing NDP policy. On Palestine, we've had discussions about Palestine with their representative in Canada, in fact. One thing that should pass definitely is to support having Palestinians full ambassador status within Canada, because that discussions, that allows the more fulsome discussions to start. But the rest of it is on the table too. Mm-hmm. BDS. I mean, we've got this is a growing campaign. 18 months ago, the Green Party, they didn't call it BDS, but it is BDS without the name. A recent poll shows how many Canadians of all parties support Palestinian rights. So, mm-hmm. So I think the NDP has to start changing their policies. This thing that we've had the last election, where I think there was at least eight candidates were disqualified from running because they had dared criticize Israel at some point in the past. And you know, people like Paul Manley, outstanding, would be an outstanding candidate. And my goodness, I mean, he was criticizing Israel because at the time Israel had locked up his father, who was part of the boat to Gaza. So you know, totally unreasonable. So I'm hoping that Henry and I and our other activists can have a bigger impact this year in Ottawa.
Well, you're familiar with the numbers and the figures. I mean, you probably know them better than I do about the percentage of the NDP's membership and of trade union membership that supports Palestinian rights, you know, to have one state, two state solutions, to do something about the occupation. There's when you talk about the labor base or the NDP base, it's different than it was 20 or 30 years ago in terms of its opinions. You know, in Europe right now, you have two kinds of social democratic parties. You have social democratic parties that are dying, that are shrinking, and you have social democratic parties that are growing. And the ones that are growing, it's because the leadership is starting to reflect the base. Mm-hmm. Corbyn in the UK and a small number of other, it's a situation, because right now there's a huge divide between the base, the membership, and leadership that seems decades out of touch on all the key issues.
Yeah, and another thing is, you know, there's been some disturbing unanimous votes of our NDP MPs. A year and a half ago, they unanimously voted to have the documentary on the so-called White Helmets get the Nobel Peace Prize. Outrageous, and it was passed unanimously. Yeah. Not a single dissenter. So we don't even. We used to have, you know, people like Sven Robinson, Libby Davies, Les Benjamin, that would stand up for the right thing, and to see, you know, the much larger caucus now not have a single dissenting vote. I find that discouraging, whether that emanates from the leader, that they no dissent is permitted, but that's still a bad sign for the party.
And I'm glad you mentioned Sven Robbins, Doug. Sven was a strong supporter of the issue, and he actually nominated my group for the Nobel Peace Prize when we were in Palestine.
Oh.
So I was always proud of that fact. I mean, but, you know, the important thing about BDS, too, which was mentioned is, you know, and BDS, by the way, is Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions. It's a peaceful movement. It's a nonviolent movement. I mean, and so I just can't understand why there's such a hue and cry against a movement. I mean, there are so many other, you know, like Black Lives Matter and all these other groups that protest with the support of the Canadian government. And part of the problem, too, when we talk about governments, it seems to me that the norm now is it's acceptable for politicians to lie. We see it south of the border. We see it within our own government. Trudeau promised to deal with Bill C-51, and they've actually made it worse with their Bill C-59, with as you mentioned, the postal issue, which I was very involved with. Trudeau, part of his campaign promise was to restore door-to-door delivery. He lied about that. And so many other issues they lied about. And Canadians seem to be, you know, there's no reaction.
There's a lot of people checking out of the process, getting depressed, because they know, like you do, that it's a very corrupt situation and you can't rely on these people. It's understood widely that you can't trust a politician to keep their word after the election, that there's one campaign for the election and then they do something completely different. And that's an opening for a party like the NDP. Because if you look at the NDP's history, back when it was the CCF, they had leaders that were solid people in some regards. Some of them were from labor and from the trade union struggle. They were from social justice and social gospel. There were, you know, people in there that you could count on that they were going to try to pursue the vision that they were talking about before the election. You know, they're also known for, sort of a tight-fisted economic management, in the sense that they weren't going to spend like crazy, that you could rely on them to try to handle the budget. So what I'm saying is, if the NDP were to put forward some really solid people with a history in the struggle, people that you know you can count on their word, that could really start to differentiate themselves from a really muddled group of politicians that we have on the scene right now.
Yeah, for sure. And, I think what we should be encouraging, too, is there's going to be a federal election in a year and a half. And, I think it's an opportunity for people in the peace and social justice movements to get more involved in the electoral process and actually run for office. We need another Sven Robinson in there. We need another Levy Davis. We need a Jeremy Corbyn. people that will really stand on principle. But I'm feeling excited about going to Ottawa in less than 2 weeks now. Henry, you're going, and we have some of our compatriots in our respective riding associations. Mm-hmm. It should be a good convention. Let's hope that they open the door for us in terms of our resolutions.
Oh, you can count on the fact that we'll be heard.
I know we will. So, Henry, thanks for your long-time continuing efforts on everything to do with peace and social justice within the NDP and outside of it. And thanks for joining us today.